Good Wednesday to you. Thank you so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad that you are with us, sponsored once again by our friends at Nosler today. Have a fantastic program for you. Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart News will join us later on in the hour. We'll talk about the 100% increase in Chicago homicides over the same time last year. And a Chicago police lieutenant writing that the answer, part of the problem, first of all, he says, lies in the fact that the now former superintendent of the Chicago Police Department, Gary McCarthy, dismantled a lot of the specialized gang units there in Chicago. And so the police department doesn't have the institutional knowledge of the officers on the street who were dealing with gangs, who were establishing relationships with informants. Now these officers are, if not flying blind, not able to acquire the sort of street-level information that is needed to adequately, to aggressively, not just adequately, but to aggressively arrest and prosecute those who are committing so many violent crimes on the streets of Chicago. He says the other problem or the other issue that can be addressed is not, again, through social programs, through good works, but through the RICO statute. He says this is the same way we dismantle the mafia. We can use it to dismantle the street gangs, but only if there is a will to do so. There's some pretty blunt talk, again, from a former police lieutenant there in Chicago. Dean Reuter, author of Liberty's Nemesis, on constitutional co-editor, I should say, of Liberty's Nemesis, the new book that came out. We talked with Dean a couple of weeks ago. We'll talk with Dean Reuter about confirmation hearings for a Supreme Court justice. President Obama saying today that he hopes and expects the Senate to hold hearings, to have a vote. But Dean Reuter says, in our system of checks and balances, the Senate's role is to be seen as a check on the power of the president. Right? Otherwise, why involve the Senate in the process? Our founding fathers, the framers, the people who devised this Constitution, the rules of law, weren't big fans of rubber stamping. They devised a system of checks and balances, this intricate system where each point has a counterpoint. So the Constitution wouldn't tell us that the Senate has a role to play here if the role was to simply go along with what the president wanted. We'll talk more with Dean Reuter about this. President Obama had his comments today. I don't know if he took questions. I don't know if he was asked about Joe Biden's repeated comments in 1992 that in the middle of an election year, the president should not nominate, should not send to the Senate a name. And Joe Biden, as the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said, I don't know, they got to hold hearings because it doesn't matter if the candidate is good or bad or indifferent. At this point in the political season, in the midst of a presidential election year, the process is unavoidably going to be purely political. Now, again, he did the typical political trick of saying, well, you know, the president were to consult with us, not just on names, but on judicial philosophy. If he were to take our recommendations and basically give us who we wanted, sure, I sure would consider it. But I think it'd be better if the president just didn't send us anybody if anybody were to retire from the Supreme Court. Things are just different now, according to President Obama, who once tried to filibuster a Supreme Court nominee. Things are different now, according to Vice President Biden, who made those comments, his own self. Things are just different now. So we'll talk with Dean Reuter about that coming up later on in the hour. Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch, they were in court yesterday trying to get a judge to agree that several of Hillary Clinton's aides need to be able to testify under oath about whether or not the State Department and Hillary Clinton intentionally set up this server to avoid compliance with things like Freedom of Information Act requests. This was a positive development if you are a fan of transparency in government. Meanwhile, Attorney General Loretta Lynch telling a House committee that the Department of Justice will conduct a review of any recommendations from the FBI and its probe of Hillary Clinton's server, and that the review would be independent. Ed Morrissey at Hot Air says that doesn't mean external, however. We're not talking about an independent investigator or a special prosecutor. It means that the review will be handled by career attorneys at the Department of Justice, and the actual decision will remain in Loretta Lynch's hands. She told the House Appropriations Committee, quote, that matter is being handled by career independent law enforcement agents, FBI agents, as well as career independent attorneys in the Department of Justice. They follow the evidence. They look at the law, and they'll make a recommendation to me when the time is appropriate. She said this will be conducted as every other case, and we will review all of the facts and handle all of the evidence and come to an independent conclusion as to how to handle it. Sure. All independently handled, right? We saw this again. I mean, this is sort of how the administration likes to say it works, right? With Operation Fast and Furious, it was all independent. Nobody within the administration actually knew what was going on. It was all those independent U.S. attorneys in Arizona and those independent ATF supervisors and those independent ATF agents who were involved in Operation Fast and Furious. None of the administration was actually aware of this, right? Same with the storefront sting operations with the ATF. Now, again, just all of these independent agencies, these independent individuals. But the actual administration in charge of overseeing this, they don't have any sway whatsoever. Very hands-off. Sure. As Ed Morrissey says, this is a nearly unprecedented situation, a criminal probe involving a former cabinet secretary currently running for the presidential nomination of the party that's in control of the executive branch. That should prompt a truly independent review, not with a political appointee as the final say, but with a James Comey-like figure with no ties to the administration who can generate the public trust to render a sound and reliable judgment. Ed says the fact that the Obama administration continues to resist this option calls Loretta Lynch's claims today into serious doubt. Also next hour, we'll talk with Congressman Mike Kelly from Pennsylvania, signing on to an amicus brief urging a court to once again curtail the president's executive reach or overreach. Kurt Liske of the Iowa Firearms Coalition will join us on the program as well. A lot of pro-gun bills making moves in the state of Iowa, but that is not to say that anti-gun activists are doing their best to try to thwart these bills. We'll get an update from Kurt. And Luke Rosiak with the Daily Caller will join us. He has a story. I don't know how much media attention that a story like this is going to get when we're in the middle of a campaign season and we have a lot of silly news out there. But this is one of those stories that I think is worth covering. We have a lot of military members who listen to this program. We certainly have a lot of veterans who listen to this program. We've talked a lot about the VA here on this program. And Luke Rosiak with the Daily Caller has the story of what happens to somebody in this administration who fails at their job, who fails the veterans that they are supposed to be caring for. Do they get fired? Do they get demoted? Are there any repercussions whatsoever? Rima Nelson Luke writes, disappeared from public view after the St. Louis Department of Veterans Affairs hospital that she managed potentially exposed 1,800 patients to HIV, was closed twice for serious medical safety issues, and ranked dead last in patient satisfaction. But she wasn't fired. In fact, she was moved halfway around the world, Luke says, to the department's only foreign facility, a seldom-used clinic inside the palatial U.S. Embassy in the Philippines capital city of Manila, where she resides in a government-provided condo and gets the same $160,000 salary that she made in St. Louis. That's a little bit more affordable to live on $160,000 a year in Manila and in the Philippines. The average person makes only $2,500 a year in Manila. So $160,000 goes a long, long way. This is what happens in the administration when you fail the people you are supposed to be serving. Which, by the way, is not to paint the VA in an unduly harsh light. As a matter of fact, our good guy of the day coming up in hour three, going to feature employees of a VA hospital in the state of Illinois. Not too far from the VA hospital in St. Louis, Missouri. We'll also have an hour three, our hero of the day, sponsored by Adcor Defense, and our deal of the day as well. So a very busy program here on today's NRA News Cam and Company. Additionally, we'll be covering some of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all around the country, including news out of Wyoming, where the House has passed a bill expanding concealed carry. Also, the Ohio House passing legislation that would allow qualified veterans to get their concealed carry license without having to go through additional training. It's House Bill 235. It would waive concealed carry license fees for active or reserve members of the armed forces, as well as for veterans. The bill passed, you ready for this? 92-2. Yeah. 92-2. Heads over to the Ohio Senate now. The primary sponsor of the bill, Representative Lou Terrar, says these men and women are our veterans. They received expert training on pistol and or rifle, and all of them who have an honorable discharge of a DD-214 or its equivalent, which is valid certification and meeting training requirements. The bill would also waive the $67 concealed carry application fee for active members of the military and those who have been retired or honorably discharged. He said the weapons training provided in the armed forces is akin to riding a bicycle. Once you've learned it, you won't forget it. Our experienced military and veterans deserve to have their training recognized. I would also say, too, that for many members of the military, it's not a matter of, I rode a bicycle when I was six, and then I haven't ridden a bicycle since, and now I'm in my 50s. I'm going to go ahead and try to hop on that bicycle. They continue to train, right, both while they are active duty and once they get out. If they are a gun owner, if they are a concealed carry holder, they are likely going to the range on a regular basis. This is part of their continuing education, so to speak. But again, 92-2 was the vote in Ohio, which kind of tells you, again, a lot about where we are in this country, really where we are in this country when it comes to the right to carry. Not where Cosmopolitan thinks we are, not where Every Town for Gun Safety wants us to be, but where we really, truly are as a country. When we have over 13 million concealed carry holders, we have record number of concealed carry holders in places like Minnesota and Michigan. You've got waiting lists that are months long now. Sheriff's offices can't handle the influx of applications in places like California. Again, this is where we are, as opposed to where the media wants us to be. Now, apparently, where Andrew Cuomo wants to be is in the White House, which is weird because he's not officially running for president yet. But the man behind the New York Safe Act, according to Frederick Dicker at the New York Post, says he is ready to step in. He is ready to go if Hillary or Bernie don't take the White House this year. He's already signaling for 2020. He will face Kanye West. Digger says senior state Democrats who've known Cuomo for decades told the Post that a speech in Buffalo last week was proof positive that the governor, once widely described as a political centrist, is seeking to use his Bernie Sanders-like progressive agenda of the nation's highest minimum wage and a costly family leave mandate as a springboard to the presidency. Huh. Not the SAFE Act, huh? Not using the New York SAFE Act, signed by Governor Cuomo in 2013, as one of his progressive bona fides. I mean, certainly the anti-gun activists were happy with him. Now, it should also be noted that there's not a lot of the SAFE Act that has actually been implemented. Some of it's been thrown out by the court. Other portions of the legislation, the New York State Police can't figure out how to implement without it costing consumers a heck of a lot of money every time they go purchase ammunition. But Governor Cuomo, he got his expanded gun ban. That part so far has withstood scrutiny by the courts. Apparently, he's not eager to run for president on that message. Wants to talk more about $15 an hour minimum wage and a family leave requirement instead. Huh. A source with strong ties to Cuomo's inner circle outlined to the New York Post the game plan that he said the governor has already has underway. Quote, Hillary may not implode, but if she does, Andrew is already making course corrections to position himself more favorably to the National Democrats in light of the rapid leftward turn of the grassroots. Andrew is to the left of Sanders on guns. Oh, there you go. Now, we'll have done a $15 minimum wage and paid family leave, and he's banned fracking. His total transformation from centrist to a leftist that actually gets things done will be complete just in time for the beginning of the next presidential cycle. So, apparently Andrew Cuomo isn't sold on the idea of a Democrat winning the White House this year. Strong signaling he's ready for 2020. All right, when we come back after a quick timeout here on this edition of NRA News Cam and Company, Dr. AWR Hawkins at Breitbart News on the staggering increase in violent crime in an already violent Chicago, plus more of the latest Second Amendment news from around the country. Stick around. We are just getting started here on this Wednesday edition of NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Well, we are here at the AdCore booth at SHOT Show 2016. AdCore, of course, our on-location sponsor for 2016. And our friend Clint Romachet, you're hanging out of the booth all week long, right?
Yeah, back here with AdCore once again for another great SHOT Show, showing off some of the rifles again and just, you know, linking back up with old friends and old people that it's good to be with.
You know, it's good that we have a chance to hang out and spend at least a couple of minutes together here. I got to tell you, I've been shooting the heck out of my AdCore rifle, and, you know, I can say it's everything that you said it would be, Clint, honestly. I mean, it is rugged, it is dependable, and it is accurate as all get out, man. I mean, really.
I mean, yeah, having you at the range day and you know, finally getting a rifle into your hands, I mean, it just, you know, you can say you can build something that's going to be accurate and reliable, but everyone can say whatever they want. It's when you come to prove it, and actions always speak louder than words, and that's what AdCore has done time and time again.
So kind of walk us through. We've got an AdCore right here, right? This is the Elite A556, right?
Yep. It's our 556, 223, whatever you want it, really. because of our gas piston system, we can go suppressed, unsuppressed, or if you're firing, like I said, 556 or Remington 223, everything's toolless, one button. I can push out, dial my gas in right there so I don't have to break my rifle apart. That it's designed to be very simplistic. said the thing that's always attracted me is the forward charging handle, non-reciprocating, ambidextrous. It allows you to stay on target and in trigger in case you have something go wrong. But the great thing about it is just that quick. If we got a lefty that's coming in to shoot right there, and he can, you know, have the same benefits of having that forward charging handle ready to go.
Again, no time-lapse photography here. I mean, it really is just that easy.
Speaking with Barry Woods with the National Wild Turkey Federation, welcome to NRA News. How are you, Barry?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having us.
Well, thanks for being here. We love National Wild Turkey Federation. You guys are a great organization. But, Barry, for those who don't know, who are watching us, what is National Wild Turkey Federation? What do you guys do?
We are in the business right now of creating hunters. We just started a new initiative called Save the Habitat, Save the Hunt. And over the course of the next 10 years through our volunteer base, we're going to create 1.5 million new hunters.
That's awesome. Why did you guys feel it was necessary to do this?
Because, unfortunately, hunter numbers are on a decline, and we recognize right away that if we're going to continue this heritage of the outdoors, that we're going to have to get kids off the couch, away from video games, and back into the outdoors. So, and we've also learned that several folks have gotten out of hunting for a number of different reasons, lack of access, lease prices, and things like that. So that's the other side of the initiative is the habitat side, and we want to open access to 500,000 acres to help those people that we create to be hunters have a place to hunt.
That sounds great. So how are you going to go about doing this? You talked about opening access. What else is in the plan?
The other thing we're doing right now is what we're calling R3 is retention, recruitment, and reactivation. And we're also holding events across the country through our volunteer base where entire families can get involved in the shooting sports. We realized real quick that Pittman-Robertson Act and the way that it works in conservation is very important to the hunting heritage. And so we got to get these folks back engaged in the outdoors. So they can get to our website at nwtf.org.
Tell folks, why should they check out your website in this new initiative?
If you want to play a role in getting hunters and recruiting hunters and becoming a volunteer with the NWTF, it's going to take a workforce. It's going to take a lot of people coming on board and helping us achieve this mission. And so if you're interested in that, you need to get on our website.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Dean Royer, co-editor of Liberty's Nemesis, joining us on the program a little bit later on in the hour, talking about confirmation hearings for a Supreme Court nominee. President Obama says he'll make that pick. But you have the Senate Judiciary Committee saying, no, you can make the pick. We're not holding the hearings. We'll talk about that a little bit later on in the hour. Right now, I want to welcome to the program Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins from Breitbart News. How you doing, sir? It's been a while.
I'm doing great, Cam. Great to speak with you.
It's good talking with you as well. And you've got a bad news story out of Chicago. Unfortunately, there's no shortage of these stories. We saw a very bad month of January, 51 homicides in the city of Chicago. And now the Chicago Tribune says that homicides have basically doubled over this time last year.
Right. Yeah, I think this time last year they had 47. This year they have 95. So it's actually one more than doubling. And by, of course, that piece, I think, when did I write that, Cam? That was yesterday or the day before. Mm-hmm. By now, there's no telling how many murders or homicides there have been because, you know, they're racking up two or three a day in that city. So who knows how many there are right now.
You know, when you say, think about this, Chicago has a quote-unquote assault weapons ban, a violence tax that raises the price of every firearm and bullet sold at retail, limits on the number of gun stores and the locations of those stores, what the New York Times describes as handgun restrictions that let city leaders, quote, get as close as they could legally to a ban without a ban. Right. As you say, these regulations represent a veritable wish list for gun controllers around the country, and yet they have correlated with more murder, not less.
Right. That's it. You know, Chicago is two things. It is the left's blueprint for the rest of the country as far as the gun laws that they would like to pass. But it's also this, and this is what we need to hold on to. It is also the most pristine example imaginable of the failure of gun control. They have every gun control measure
that the people at the federal level would love to have, the assault weapons ban, of course, being key. Mm-hmm. All the measures they have that you just read, and what do we see? Not just that crime maintains a dangerous, is maintained at a dangerous level, but that crime and violence are skyrocketing. And people are losing their lives left and right. And it's a lesson in the futility of gun control.
You know, and it's interesting. Crane's Chicago Business had an opinion piece today by Robert Angone, who's a former police lieutenant there in Chicago. And he didn't, in all of his writings about what can be done and how bad it's gotten in Chicago, he never once said what we need is more gun control laws. Right. He didn't blame. He didn't say, you know, Indiana needs to have Chicago's laws. He didn't say Wisconsin needs to have Chicago laws. He didn't say Congress needs to get together and make federal gun laws look like Chicago's. What he said is, quote, to regain control, we have to get our police department back to a professional force that has respect of the communities that it serves. He says right now the gang shooters and their affiliates are having their way with little or no interference from law enforcement. Gone are the specialists who kept intelligence on all the leaders, emerging leaders, and their turf. They knew the gang colors and the signs and who the main leaders were. Former police superintendent Gary McCarthy broke up those units, saying that he was putting a stop to, quote, cowboying by specialized units. Now the officers are out of the neighborhoods, back in the districts, answering calls of dog bites and domestic issues. Says he threw the baby out with the bathwater. With no one to gather intelligence and no one to make the gang affiliation connections, no one is safe. You know, rather than saying, well, what it is we just need to pass this piece of legislation to make everything better, he's actually saying, listen, there were things that were done within the police department that make our job of protecting and serving the community more difficult. In other words, this isn't necessarily a problem that was committed by the voters. This isn't a gun rights issue. This is something where the policing changed, made it harder for the police to actually go after the gang members who are committing the violent crimes. And the gang members know that there is less enforcement, less prosecution, less intelligence going around. And there's been a cause and effect here.
Right. Yeah. Well, I would agree with that 100%. And I can see that under McCarthy. There was no doubt about that. I think, though, there is a combination. I think there needs to be, police need to be able to return to that real policing you're talking about. But at the same time, the exercise of gun rights has to be widened. Because it's simply not fair that a single mom or a family, a married family in a poor neighborhood, that they have to lock their doors and hide in a room to try to keep from getting shot, robbed, mugged, raped, whatever happens, that they just have to take their chances every night. That denies them dignity. We need to both return to real policing and be sure that family, that single mom, can exercise their Second Amendment rights, acquire the gun they need in order to defend themselves and their family.
Absolutely. And listen, there are things that the city could do if they, again, respected the rights of its residents to keep and bear arms. They could, you know, they could make it actually, they could waive those government fees, Dr. Hawkins, for you to apply for your firearm owner ID card, for you to apply for your concealed carry license. They could say, you know what, if you live in one of these very violent neighborhoods, you don't have to pay a fee. In fact, we're going to expedite your concealed carry permit. They could actually allow for the development of ranges in the city of Chicago so people could actually get trained, right? They could get the training that the city says they should have, but the city tries to block them from getting.
I covered that very type of thing in Oklahoma yesterday. In Oklahoma, Creek County Sheriff, I believe his name is John Davis, but the Creek County Sheriff is waiving as much of the fingerprint fee as he can for concealed carry licenses. He's finding every corner like that he has the power to cut as a law enforcement official, and he's cutting it. Because he said he wants people to be able to afford to come in, get their concealed carry license so they can carry a gun to defend themselves. That's the attitude you're talking about that we need to see in Chicago. You couple that with a return to real policing, and the left would be dismayed. They would be blown away by the about face we would see on crime.
I think you're right. I think the people of Chicago would be infinitely better off. You know, there's another sheriff, I think, down in Florida. I think it's the Broward County Sheriff. He's actually putting on free firearms training. And we're seeing this as well. You know, there is a response by law enforcement around the country. And the response, generally speaking, unless you're talking about, again, politically appointed police superintendents or police chiefs, the answer from these elected law enforcement officials really seems to be, we want you to be able to protect yourself. And so we're going to do everything that we can to ensure that you can do that.
Right. And that's how it should be. And, you know, the closer you get to the people, Cam, and you and I have talked about that in elections and different things, the closer you get to the people, the more you see this kind of thing. A president or a senator might be able to get elected and hold some anti-gun views. But when you get down to the representative level, the mayoral level, different things, the closer you get to the people, these county sheriffs, they know that if their constituents are going to be safe, ultimately their constituents need access to guns to exercise their Second Amendment rights. That's what I love when these sheriffs do these things, what you're talking about, what I'm talking about. It's what they need to do in Chicago.
You know, and it's interesting. We were talking with Eric Keyes, Iggy, from Top Shot Season 4. He's a police officer in the Chicago area. He's also a firearms instructor. And, you know, they're actually training a lot of people. They have no shortage of individuals who are, you know, filling up their classes so that they can get their concealed carry license. The demand, I think, is there. And, in fact, I think it was the Chicago Tribune a few months ago took a look at the zip codes of where these concealed carry holders are in Chicago. And what they found is that there are a lot of concealed carry holders in neighborhoods where a lot of cops live, and there are a lot of concealed carry holders in violent neighborhoods. And it's not that the concealed carry holders are committing the violent crimes. They are getting their guns so that they can protect themselves against violent criminals. It is already happening, and it is happening over the objections of the city. Imagine what it would be like if the city actually wanted to empower its residents to be able to exercise their rights rather than spending every waking hour trying to make it as hard as possible for them to do so.
Right. Well, you know, I left out of my piece, and you made me think. You remember when concealed carry was passed and when the city had to adopt it, Rahm Emanuel came out as quick as he could to institute, quote unquote, safety corridors. And these were going to be whole swaths of the city where you couldn't carry a gun concealed because that was either a school bus route or a route where children walked a lot, all these things, basically creating all these gun-free zones throughout the city that will only be gun-free for law-abiding citizens. The criminals will prey on them and are preying on them. That's the kind of approach that has to be rejected.
Talking again with Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins from Breitbart. All right, we've only got time for maybe one more topic here. West Virginia, I know you've been talking about this. Permitless carry is apparently on its way to Governor Earl Ray Tomlin's desk. There was a procedural move that expedited passage, got it out of the House of Representatives and onto the governor's desk, where the governor is expected to veto this. But it looks like, Dr. Hawkins, you know, you only need a simple majority to override the governor's veto. It looks like the legislature has worked quickly enough after the governor vetoed similar legislation last year that they're going to be able to override Governor Tomlin's veto, and things look pretty good right now for permitless
carry. Right, yeah. You know, I was reading his comments this morning. He seems bound and determined to veto this, period. You know, he talked about that there were improvements over the bill last year, but he's still not happy with it. And so ultimately, he and Senator Manchin and some different people in the state are opposed to the Second Amendment being a sufficient carry permit. And I'm with you. I believe the legislature is determined to override it this time if he does follow through. And I hope they do override it.
Well, I hope they do, too. We ended up talking with the Representative Sarah Blair, who was one of the chief sponsors of the bill, 19 years old, already a state representative there in West Virginia. And one of the things that she liked about the bill, one of the reasons why she supported it, because she's a Second Amendment supporter, but this also, in addition to permitless carry, it revises the concealed carry law. So that West Virginians 18, 19, 20 years of age can now get their concealed carry license. Here you have a state representative who's faced threats against her life. And she's old enough to legally own a gun. She's old enough to serve in office. She's old enough to vote. She's old enough to serve in the military. But right now, under state law, she can't carry a firearm to defend herself.
Right. I'm a fan. I'm a fan of Blair's. You know, I read, of course, it's her bill that they've passed, but I read her comments and I read her gutsiness and the way she pushes these things. And as you say, her age magnifies all that. I'm a fan of hers, and I hope she succeeds here for many reasons. And her own safety is one of the reasons. She should be able to carry a weapon for self-defense, just like the rest of us. As you say, she's old enough to own the gun. Surely then she's old enough to keep the gun with her to protect her life.
Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins with Breitbart News. Appreciate you coming on the program, sir, and I look forward to talking to you again very soon.
Oh, thank you, Cam. God bless you, my friend.
You too. We'll speak soon. Dr. A.W. Hawkins here with us on NRA News, Cam and Company. Still to come, Dean Reuter, co-editor of Liberty's Nemesis, the new book talking about President Obama's executive overreach. We'll talk with Dean about the confirmation hearings, or lack thereof. What is the role of the Senate here? Because we have all of these wise advisors who told us back when George H.W. Bush was president that the role of the Senate at this point in time was to not allow the sitting president to send a nominee to the court, not in the midst of a presidential election year, not when the process would be inevitably tainted, not just tainted, but drenched, saturated with the worst kind of partisan politics. Throw all that out the window, because none of that matters, apparently. Now these very same wise, trusted advisors are telling us the Constitution demands not only that the president send a nomination to the Senate, but that the Senate consider this nomination. And quite frankly, you know, the Constitution says advise and consent. It doesn't say disagree. So why doesn't the Senate just provide its rubber stamp to whoever President Obama wants to nominate? We'll talk about it with Dean Reuter right after this quick timeout here on NRA News, Cam and Company.
I'm speaking with Kellyanne Pidgeon with Armed and Feminine. Kellyanne, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Tell folks, what is Armed and Feminine? What do you do and why?
Armed and Feminine is my business that I created to teach firearms training for women only. When I got into shooting several years ago, there was no one I could find that was female, and it was a little difficult because men are from Mars, women are from Venus.
No.
So I went to an NRA training through the Well-Armed Woman and became an instructor, and I came back and started this, and it took off like wildfire. People came from all over the tri-state area. I'm in Pennsylvania, and they loved the idea of women teaching women. You know, we have to know, how does this work? What is it called? What does it do? We have to feel things, touch things, and that's what the entire classes are based around, is women teaching women, because we're different. We have smaller hands. We're not as strong. We're curvier in different ways, totally different on how you have to learn how to shoot.
Right, and especially with certain firearms, the fit, whether it's revolver, semi-automatic, if you're handgun, it's a different fit for a woman's hands versus a man's.
Absolutely. And that's actually one of the draws about my class, is that when someone comes, all they have to do is bring a lunch. I bring everything, eyes, ears, materials, and an array of firearms, and so do my other instructors. So they have an opportunity to pick and choose from all different firearms to see what fits for them. And everything is different. And it's funny, I have a video out that akins the firearm to buying your bra, if we can go there on this segment.
Of course, we always go there here.
And I say that nobody can buy your firearm but you. You know, when someone said, oh, my husband bought this for me, and I just want to roll my eyes and go, really?
Honey, I got you a 44 Magnum. It's called the Dirty Harry Special. Enjoy.
Exactly. And they're never going to want to shoot again. Like,
no.
Guys are like, honey, try this big firearm. So we start with 22s till we get all the fundamentals down pat, and then we move up to 380s and 9s until they figure out what it is that they like. But I tell them, you know, it's just like your bra. It's got to be comfortable. It's got to fit right. You've got to be able to wear it every day, and it's got to be able to do its job. So only you can do that.
Perfect. Speaking with Kellyanne Pidgeon with Armed and Feminine. So, Kellyanne, you say you're from PA. What part of the state?
I live near Pittsburgh.
Okay. I'm a PA guy myself, and in Virginia now, but it's always good to have a fellow Pennsylvanian here.
I find them everywhere. Actually, I found a man right who lives not by me from
That's
here.
Awesome. So why was it important that you do? You talked about you didn't find it, but you went way beyond. I can't find a woman to instruct me. You started this whole thing, and it takes a lot of work and a lot of drive.
It does.
What drove you to do this?
I know how much I enjoyed it and what learning this trade did for me in terms of confidence, et cetera. I'm all about mentoring women. I won the Athena Award locally for mentoring women and trying to help move them. And in the classes, I found women who were housekeepers, from housekeepers to attorneys and everybody in between. And what I saw is that women who may be fearful in one way or another, once you teach them how to safely handle a firearm, their confidence just goes through the roof. And if they're having a bad day or they feel like their back's up against the wall for something, they just have to remember, hey, I know how to shoot a gun, and I can do that pretty well. I can do anything. And so, you know, I just enjoy helping people. My real job is in human services, and folks look to me for leadership sort of all the time. And so it was just sort of another calling that I had, and I found it to be a passion. I thought, if I'd only started this 10 years earlier, this would have been awesome. So I enjoy it. I enjoy every minute of it.
How can folks get more information about Armed and Feminine?
Actually, they can visit my website. It's armedandfeminine.com, and all the tabs are there, from frequently asked questions, class descriptions. All my classes are pretty much sold out for the next season. It's crazy. My entire 2016 season sold out in 5 days. 5 days. I had to add more slots to that during the week to try to just meet the demand.
Okay. So before we run out of time here,
sure.
What's your message to women who are watching us going, should I try that? What do you tell them?
Don't be afraid. You can conquer your fears. It's worth it. And we need to move from being the protected to becoming the protector. And women will save the Second Amendment.
Wow. That's awesome.
Well, they will.
That's awesome.
Give me 30 more seconds. Because women who are the matriarchs of their family, whatever they like, believe in, and support, so will their children. And so women are on the move, and we're moving this, and we're going to be a big part of saving the Second Amendment.
Kellyanne, thank you so much. Keep doing what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
John, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Welcome back to NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch coming up on the program next hour. Also, Congressman Mike Kelly of Pennsylvania right now. I want to welcome the co-editor of Liberty's Nemesis, Dean Reuter, to the program. Dean, it's good to talk with you again.
Thank you for having me on, Cam.
My pleasure. So President Obama today said that he plans on sending a nominee to the Senate very soon. Quote, as senators prepare to fulfill their constitutional responsibility to consider the person I appoint, I hope they'll move quickly to debate and then confirm this nominee so that the court can continue to serve the American people at full strength. We've heard the argument by the administration that this would be sheer obstinance for the Republicans to not consider a nominee by President Obama. But we've also heard then-Senator Joe Biden back in 1992 explain that he didn't think then-President Bush should send a nominee to the Senate if there was a retirement in the midst of a presidential election year, because inevitably it would be entangled in politics. It wouldn't matter what kind of candidate was presented, that inevitably it would just turn into a three-ring circus. So what is your position on, what the president is saying, and then we'll talk about what the Constitution actually says.
Sure. Well, in that one short statement, the president says a lot. I mean, it's clear the president has a duty to nominate someone, under the Constitution. The Senate has a duty to, under its rules, to consider the nomination. There's no time requirement. There's not as if the president sends somebody up and says, I need this back from you guys in the Senate next Wednesday or next month. There's also no requirement of some level of activity. They receive the nomination, and their consideration can end with at that point. They're not required to do an investigation. They're not required to hold hearings. They're not required to have a committee vote, and they're not required to have a floor vote. If you look at, you know, our divided government, the branches of government, the separation of powers, it gives the president one power and it gives the Senate another power. And the Senate's power a lot of times with regard to the executive is to check executive power. Mm-hmm. This would be the perfect example of them checking executive power by not confirming the president's nominee.
Absolutely. You know, the system is a system of checks and balances, not a system of rubber stamps. Right?
That's exactly right. And you can look at the Senate's role here as putting the brakes on the president. And he also mentioned the court operating in its fullest capacity or something, some language like that. You know, when this country began, there were 6 members on the court. That was the full court. And there's nothing in the Constitution about how many justices there will be. That's set by statute. We've had as many as 10 at a time. And There's nothing magical about eight, and there's nothing fatal about the court continuing to operate with eight at a time. It has done so in the past for extended periods of time, as recently as 2010 when Justice Kagan came on the court. She had been Solicitor General, so she was involved in a lot of cases in the lower courts. She had to recuse herself 28 times that first term, so which is more than a third of the cases. So more than a third of the cases that term were decided by a 4-4 vote, an eight-person court, I should say, not a 4-4 tie, but an eight-person court. And the court functioned just fine. It can re-argue cases if it wants to when a ninth justice gets appointed. It can hold cases over. It can decide cases 4-4. The statistics show that not many of the cases would be decided that way in all likelihood.
So, the Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has said, look, the Senate Judiciary Committee has unanimously told me they don't want to hold hearings, so I don't think we're going to hold hearings. Said that he doubts he would even meet with the nominee. Dean, this is now when inevitably, as Biden said back in 1992, inevitably this becomes a political circus, right? And no matter what happens, this will be a political circus. If there are no confirmation hearings, then that will be the controversy for the news cycle periodically from now until Election Day. If they did hold hearings and they didn't vote to confirm the nominee, that would be the controversy from now until Election Day. The narrative is sort of already set here, it seems to me, by the president and his advisors, that no matter what the Republicans do, unless it is to bend over and acquiesce to what the president wants, then they are going to be painted and portrayed as recalcitrant opponents of liberty and freedom.
Yeah, I think you described the road ahead pretty well. Those are the two alternatives, I think. But one thing I would note just for the record here is that this is also vastly important. The stakes are so high with a single appointment to the court because the court is divided, but also because the federal government wields outlandish amounts of government. Outlandish amounts of power, I'm sorry. The federal government has more power now than it has ever had before. So the stakes are so high, and that's why you'll see a pitched political battle no matter which direction this thing goes.
Talking again with Dean Reuter, the new book is Liberty's Nemesis. And Dean, I mean, this really is sort of a look at what you and your co-editor and all of the contributors to Liberty's Nemesis are writing about here in the book, right? The overreach of the executive branch.
That's right. And one way to sort of curb that overreach is with a strong judiciary. That's why this appointment is so valuable, so important, and, you know, why the Senate, I think, has dug in here.
And you know, it's interesting because it's important regardless of who that nominee turns out to be, right? Because it's not actually about the nominee. The Senate's move here is about the power of the Senate and reasserting the power of the Senate. It, in fact, coming out before the president has even named a nominee would indicate that it's not actually about the nominee at all. It's about the relationship. It's about, again, that balance of power between the executive branch and the legislative branch.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the courts were probably the first branch of government to recognize the growth of power, the fact that the power was getting out of balance. The unaccountable administrative state was gaining too much power, and the courts are for the first time beginning to rein things in there. You can see they were beginning to question whether or not they should defer too much to Congress when Congress delegates power to agencies. And they were beginning to question themselves, the courts were, about whether they should defer to agencies when agencies exercise power, or they should, you know, put more stringent requirements on agencies. You know, some agencies aren't required when they make rules, they're not required to engage in cost-benefit analysis, the simple kind of calculations you and I do in our everyday lives when we, you know, decide whether to go to the movies or whether to go to the groceries. You just figure out how you want to spend your resources. In some instances, agencies don't do that when they're passing regulations that amount to hundreds of millions of dollars of impact. So the courts were in the process of reassessing their relationship with the executive branch. And now that I think the Senate has taken cognizance of that, and they're going to say, let's just put the brakes on here. Let's just pause for a minute.
Just out of curiosity, Dean, was that recognition that you talked about in the courts, was that occurring solely at the Supreme Court level, or are we also seeing that at the appellate courts and even in federal trial courts?
Primarily two places, most notably in the Supreme Court, but also in what a lot of people would call is the second highest court in the land. That's the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. A lot of these administrative agency cases go through the D.C. Court of Appeals. So they were beginning to take note of agency growths in power and starting to try and trim it back. Sometimes that wasn't the full court. Sometimes that was one or two judges dissenting and taking issue with what was happening.
All right. Again, we're talking with the co-editor of Liberty's Nemesis, the unchecked expansion of the state, Dean Reuter, John Yu, the other co-editor, a fantastic book. I will tell you, it is chock full of stuff that'll raise your blood pressure. And Dean, I think of myself as a fairly calm and even tempered guy, but I've had to put this book down, set it aside, walk away for a little bit on a few occasions, because it is, you know, rarely do we see the sort of sum total of all of these actions throughout the administrative state. And so when you have this laundry list of here's how the administrative state has been expanded over the past less than a decade, I got to tell you, I mean, it's almost numbing to the senses.
It is. I mean, when I told my friends that I was writing about the growth of the federal government, my follow-up line was, well, it's a 10-volume set. And we do try and give the reader as comprehensive a look as possible and talk about some themes and the way this happened and the way to get back to normal. But it really is daunting, and it's really disturbing, and it's really unsettling. And if you're a fan of big government, this book is not for you, because it really does amount to a pretty hard critique of big government ideas.
Absolutely. And it is, again, it's well worth reading. It is sort of horrifying. It's scarier than any Stephen King novel, because it's real, Dean.
It does strike in reality, and it's our country. I mean, this is not the country our founders envisioned. And, you know, my view always is, if we want to change the Constitution, if we want to change the structure of government, you need to do it through a constitutional amendment. You can't do it just by accreting power to unaccountable bureaucrats who, you know, they might be as well-intended as they can be, but their nature, and their human nature, is to exercise power you have. So that's what they do all day long. They regulate and they enforce.
Absolutely. And the difference being, you know, when we're talking about a constitutional amendment, now we hear complaints, oh, it's hard. You can never get a constitutional amendment passed. Look, that is the power of the people, for better or worse. That is where we, the people, have our most overt display of power, is through the amendment of the Constitution, right? And clearly we make mistakes. I would say the prohibition was a fairly big mistake, but we also hold it within ourselves to correct that mistake. And it only took, look, it took less than a decade, right, for the American people to realize, whoops, that was a bad idea. How many government programs that you can now go back and look at and say, well, that really didn't do what it was supposed to do, are still in place decades later because they weren't put in place through a constitutional amendment. They weren't even put in place through legislation. It was just the simple assertion that such a program, such a department needed to exist.
No, and you see it again and again and again. It's. I mean, it would be an unfortunate story if it were just one agency, just one rule. But if you take a look at the laws passed by Congress as opposed to the regulations and other informal rules, but binding, passed by the agencies, it's the agencies that are exercising true power in this country. And the legislature knows it. So, I mean, one other point of power the people exercise here is to elect a small government president and elect congressmen and women that are going to rein in the administrative state and take back the power that belongs to Congress. Most of the power that resides in the administrative state is really legislative power that Congress should be exercising. Instead, they delegate to the administrative state.
Listen, Dean, I really appreciate you coming on the program. It's always a pleasure talking with you, and I hope we can do this again soon.
Thank you. It's good to catch up with you, Cam.
Absolutely. Dean Reuter joined us, co-editor of Liberty's Nemesis, out now from Encounter Books. Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch will join us on the program. For a perfect example of what we were just talking about here, it was about a year ago that the ATF decided it was going to try to ban green tip ammunition. Not through legislation, right? Congress didn't decide it was going to try to ban this ammunition. A government agency decided it was going to try to ban this ammunition. Currently available. Just got to pass a regulation that said, no, you couldn't own it anymore. Right? No vote taken whatsoever. A public comment period. And thankfully, because of your efforts, the public comments were loud, and there were many, and the decision was eventually rescinded. But that's an example of what Dean is talking about here. The growth of the administrative state, where the rules and the laws that you and I live by increasingly are not passed by Congress. They are not amended to our U.S. Constitution by a vote of we the people. Bureaucrats that you will never meet, never vote for, promulgate these regulations that you will likely never hear of until you might run afoul of them. That's how a lot of stuff gets done in Washington, D.C. today. And where, again, is the check and balance for that type of activity? Right, stick around. Hour two of NRA News Cam & Company, sponsored by Nosler, is coming up right after this quick timeout.
I'm speaking with Michael Faw of Crimson Trace. Michael, how are you, sir?
Good, John. How are you today?
I am doing great. Thanks for being back here on NRA News. All right, so ran into you here. You've got a really cool new product to show us. Tell folks, what is Crimson Trace? What do you guys do?
Crimson Trace is a laser siding manufacturer out in the Portland, Oregon area. We make more than 200 laser siding systems for firearms. We also make military siding hardware.
How does Crimson, give us a quick story of how Crimson Trace came about as a company.
Came up with an idea from our founder, Lou Danielson, and then that was more than 20 years ago. We've been in business that long, and the product lines have evolved since then. So it was a concept he had, and he just grew it into what today is known as Crimson Trace, the
right.
Great American story.
And I'll tell you what did you mention for me on the air? What, over 200 product lines?
Over 200 products. We have red and green laser siding systems now.
It's awesome. And I'll tell you what, Michael, when you talk to people in the industry, in shooting sports competitive, no matter what, it's one of those names, Crimson Trace is, you know, everyone knows about it. You talk about having a strong brand.
One of the reasons we have so many products, we listen to customers. We know that a lot of NRA members are current customers, and we listen to what customers ask for or suggestions, and that's where the product base grows from.
And you also mentioned something about NRA members.
Yes. All of our employees are also NRA members. We pay the membership for the ones who don't join on their own, but we're all 100% NRA.
And it's so awesome, Michael, when a manufacturer understands that we're all in this fight together.
And they enjoy also getting the magazines and their hats.
I love it. Speaking with Michael Faw, and he's the Public and Media Relations Manager for Crimson Trace. All right, so show us what you got, my friend. What is this?
Okay, this year we're known also for innovation. We've come up with a wireless system. The module is activated by the grip. So you can take your standard AR rifle grip off, and as long as your gun also has a rail somewhere on it, you can attach the module. So this grip is paired with that sight. So it's a laser and a light. So you can activate it this, and it's... There's more than 256 different signatures and codes that those two pieces of equipment communicate with, so there's no hacking it or no problems or anything else. So it's a wireless system designed by Crimson Trace.
Laser and a light and a wireless system, pretty cool stuff. So tell folks, what's the advantage of having a system like this?
It leaves you've got one hand that's control of your firearm. You've got the other hand that's free. You don't have to keep reaching up. You don't have to worry about wires. You don't have to worry about cables or anything else that's getting snagged on anything if you're moving through either the brush or a building or anything. So we know that this has hunting applications for people who are pursuing pigs and coyotes, and then it also has home defense applications. And we are growing the number of modules and the options that will be available, but it will all be controlled by the grip, the pistol grip.
It has applications here with the NRA News Crew. As soon as you broke it out, we're showing to everyone, just about everybody here wants to get one.
Folks are lined up at the booth also looking at it. And yesterday at the range, we had an event, and people were lined up and just, you know, let me see this. We've heard all about it.
Let me see it. Let me have one.
Yeah, let me have one is the big request.
Michael Fall with Crimson Trace. How can folks get more information about Crimson Trace?
Obviously, crimsontrace.com. is the fastest way to get information. And then we also have more than 2,500 dealers across the U.S. So most gun ranges and gun shops sell our products. They can go in there and look at a catalog, or they can call 800-442-2406 and request a catalog. We'll send a free one. The website's also a store. They can buy stuff there. We know that all dealers don't necessarily stock all right. 200 products.
Michael, thank you so much for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Hey, John, thanks for having me.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch coming up a little bit later on in the program. Hillary Clinton's attorney's back in federal court. Not a good day. Actually, I think this was a Department of State attorney's back in court yesterday. Still not a good day. Still not a good day for the Democratic candidate, as a judge said, Yeah, we're going to grant discovery into whether or not the State Department and Hillary Clinton deliberately tried to get around the Freedom of Information Act by setting up this private server. So we are going to require or allow several of Hillary's deputies to testify under oath about what they knew about the setting up of said server and why it was put in place. Congressman Mike Kelly of Pennsylvania is going to join us later on in the hour as well. Meanwhile, in federal court out in California, a federal district judge has sentenced former state senator Leland Yee to 5 years behind bars for, quote, trading political favors for campaign contributions. Is that really what it was? Huh. Paragraph two from the LA Times, Maura Dolan and Patrick McGreevy. Yee admitted in a plea deal that he was part of a racketeering conspiracy that involved exchanging official acts for money, conspiring to traffic in weapons, and money laundering. Huh. Conspiring to traffic in weapons. Because Leland Yee was a big gun control advocate out there in California, the state Senate. That's weird. Specifically, the LA Times says Lee promised an undercover FBI agent favors in return for campaign contributions. Yeah, he also said that he could get machine guns for Raymond Shrimp Boy Chow, I believe was the allegation. Huh. During the hour-long proceedings, Senator Yee, asked the court for a leniency in light of his public humiliation. Is that generally a reason why the court would go light on someone for their sentence? Like, I've been really embarrassed by all of this, Your Honor. His wife's severe illness, his admissions of wrongdoing, and his past record of public service. Yee told the judge that his crimes had hurt his family, his supporters, government institutions, and the public. He says, that will always weigh on me, and that will always haunt me for the rest of my life. U.S. District Judge Charles Breyer, according to the LA Times, said he did not feel he should be lenient. He said, the crimes that you committed have resulted in essentially an attack on democratic institutions, saying that Yee made it clear that his Senate vote was for sale. He said, the crimes that you've committed, in this court's view, this is a very serious violation of trust. Votes are not for sale. Positions are not for sale. And your conduct indicating that it was for sale was a violation of trust. Huh. Isn't it interesting? You know, the anti-gun activists always talk about politicians being bought by the NRA. And here we have an actual anti-gun politician whose vote and position, according to a federal judge, was actually up for sale. Government prosecutors had asked that Yee's sentence include 8 years in prison, a 3-year term of supervised release, a fine of $25,000, as well as a $100 special assessment. Prosecutor said Yi demonstrated that he was a public servant who was willing to betray the trust of those who elected him by being prepared to sell his vote to the highest bidder. Yi's attorneys, citing the poor health of his wife and the ex-lawmaker's long years of service, where his vote apparently was up for sale. I'm not sure why you get credit for serving in a position where the prosecutor and the judge says your vote was up for sale. Well, I did it for a really long time, Your Honor. I'm not sure that, again, that's an argument for leniency. As the attorney said, today Yi is a 67-year-old man who has accepted responsibility for his conduct and pleaded guilty before this court. He has led an otherwise exemplary life as a family man, an active voice for the betterment of society, and a volunteer. He also agreed to forfeit about $33,000, mostly from his campaign account for Secretary of State. LA Times says Yi was a state senator when an undercover FBI agent recorded him making promises in exchange for campaign money from May 2011 through March of 2014. He was running for Secretary of State when he was arrested. He was one of five state lawmakers, one of them no longer in office, charged with crimes in 2014. As a result of the scandal, the LA Times said, the legislature placed a measure on this year's June ballot asking voters to approve suspension without pay for, quote, errant lawmakers. The state constitution right now requires suspensions with pay. So even when you're arrested on federal corruption charges, you are still drawing a paycheck there. LA Times says the prosecution's also led to a significant court ruling in which a judge for the first time said that the public had the right to see legislators' office calendars and emails, despite a state law that has protected legislative documents from public disclosure. The Senate adopted resolutions last year that banned members from fundraising during the last month of the legislative session and the month leading up to a budget vote. Resolutions also require the Senate Rules Committee to appoint an ethics ombudsman to accept allegations of wrongdoing and protect whistleblowers from retaliation. Governor Jerry Brown vetoed the legislation that would have created a tougher rule, said in one of his veto messages, according to the LA Times, that the proposed rules on campaign funds, quote, would add more complexity to existing regulations, quote, without reducing undue influence. And Leland Yi heading to prison, federal prison, for the next 5 years. I believe with the five-year sentence, he is not eligible for early release. Federally speaking, he would have to do 85% of his sentence before he was eligible. So he will be behind bars for at least a few years here. And in New Jersey, Republicans in the New Jersey State Assembly they are actually trying to change the law. They want to pass legislation that would make it easier for prosecutors to reduce or change charges against someone from out of state accused of breaking New Jersey's gun possession laws. Assemblyman Minority Leader John Bramnick told New Jersey Advance Media that the measure would officially make the state attorney general's guidelines that give prosecutors discretion not to seek mandatory minimum sentences state law. And he also says that Republicans are drafting another bill to make sure that someone carrying convicted of carrying a gun illegally in New Jersey would no longer face a mandatory minimum sentence of 3.5 years in jail. This was a measure, by the way, Michael Bloomberg. One of that very same sentence for illegal gun possession in the state of New York. Got it, by the way. Now, it's still being plea bargained. It's not occurring in all cases. But the law in the books is that if you're caught in illegal possession of a firearm in New York, it's 3.5 years minimum. Assemblyman Bramnick says, we want bad guys with guns to go to jail. But we don't want good guys who maybe made a stupid decision and forgot that there's a gun in the vehicle to go to jail for 3 years. The pair outlining the initiative of Bramnick, along with Assemblyman Declan O'Scanlan, outlining the initiative in Trenton. So the measures, inspired by recent cases and news stories that highlighted the issue in New Jersey, like the case of the corrections officer from Pennsylvania, or Stephen Josie Davis, or any number of other cases, including some cases that we haven't really even talked about on this program. Brian Lee Fletcher, North Carolina, arrested last year while performing emergency repairs after a storm in Hamilton Township, who voluntarily told a police officer that he had a legally owned handgun in his car. Arrested. Pardoned by Governor Christie back in October. Elizabeth Jane Griffin of Florida tried to board a ferry from Jersey City to Ellis Island with a legally owned firearm. Again, had to be pardoned by Governor Christie. NJ.com says New Jersey doesn't recognize other states' gun licenses. Nope, they don't. And they don't issue a lot there within the state of New Jersey either. People from out of state convicted of violating state gun laws get a minimum 3.5 years behind bars. Assemblyman Bramnick says people who forget that there's a handgun but you're used to carrying it in 40 states and you make a mistake by bringing it into this state, you should go to jail for 3 years? No, absolutely not. But again, the majority in the New Jersey legislature seems more interested in trying to pass bills that would require gun store owners to carry smart guns, regardless of whether or not there's any demand among customers for them. That's the priority for the Democrats in the legislature in New Jersey this year, revising the smart gun law that is already on the books. Now, you know, I think this is a step in the right direction. Frankly, again, I'd like to see, as someone who has family members who still live in New Jersey, who spent a little bit of time in New Jersey as a kid, who married a Jersey girl, I'd like to see the state actually just adopt shall issue. And I know that Scott Bach would like to see that as well, head of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs. Given the makeup of the state Senate, not likely that that's going to happen, unfortunately. But maybe you can get enough members of the majority to go along and recognize that, yeah, this is dumb to keep wasting resources and to keep wasting our reputation by going after people who are very clearly not committing violent crimes in the state of New Jersey. It is a waste of time, it is a waste of money, and again, it is a waste of reputation to continue to do this. Let's get real. Let's focus our attention. Let's make it a priority to actually go after the people who are committing violent crimes with firearms, not again the corrections officer who thought that he was covered under H.R. 218, or the individual who stopped to do some emergency repairs to his vehicle and was from out of state. No word yet on whether or not these measures have received any early support from Democrats there in New Jersey, but this apparently will be a legislative priority for Republicans in the Garden State of New Jersey this session. We'll keep our eyes both on that piece of legislation as well as the provisions by the anti-gun advocates to push that smart gun bill. Meanwhile, in Congress this week, the Sportsman Heritage and Recreational Enhancement Act, the SHARE Act, is expected to be considered on the House floor. It's H.R. 2406. It would expand access to and opportunities for hunting, fishing, recreational shooting. It would give law-abiding gun owners more access to carry firearms on land managed by the Army Corps of Engineers. It would protect lead-based ammunition. It promoted the construction and maintenance of public target ranges, which, again, one would think the self-proclaimed gun safety advocates would be all in favor of, because if you're in favor of gun safety, you want people to get that education and training. You want those locations and facilities to be as common as they can possibly be so that as many people as possible have the opportunity to get that education and training. So you'd think this would be something that the quote-unquote gun safety advocates would be all in favor of. I'm not sure that's the case, though. suppose, again, if you're a real gun safety advocate, you're in favor of this. If you're an anti-gun advocate, you're probably not in favor of this, because why on earth would you want to expand the opportunities for people to actually go and use a firearm safely and responsibly, right? Because you're anti-gun. And there is the possibility, there is always the possibility that when this legislation comes up in the House, that there will be attempts to try to attach anti-gun or anti-hunting amendments. This being an election year, of course, everything's going to get political, right? So we should expect an attempt to do this here if the bill comes up on the floor of the House this week. So make sure, if you're a gun owner, that you've let your representative know your thoughts on H.R. 2406, the Sportsman's Heritage and Recreational Enhancement Act. We'll maybe even ask Congressman Mike Kelly about that coming up when he joins us a little bit later on in the program. Right now, though, we're going to step away for just a moment or two. When we return here on NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch joins us. They were in court yesterday talking about Hillary Clinton's private email server, whether or not it was set up to thwart the Freedom of Information Act in this country, among other possibilities. Stick around. We'll get the details from Chris right after this quick timeout here on NRA News, Cam and Company.
Speaking with Jose Morales, NRA training counselor. Jose, welcome to NRA News. We want to talk about the three rules of firearm safety. What are those?
Thank you very much for having me. The three NRA safety rules. The first one, the primary rule, is always keep the gun pointed in a safe direction. Now, what that means is we want to make sure that if that gun discharges by accident, that it's in the safest direction possible, the direction it will cause if the gun were to discharge, the least amount of property damage, the least amount of possibility of injury possible. And it's our responsibility to make sure that we never point the muzzle, which is the front of the barrel, at anything we don't want to shoot, including ourselves.
Okay. Rule number two.
Rule number two is always keep your finger off the trigger until you're ready to fire, which is common sense, but as my mother says all the time, common sense is not that common. We need to make sure that our finger in my pretend gun is on the side of the gun, away from the trigger guard at all times. And our finger only enters the trigger guard when we're ready to shoot, and as soon as we're done, it's removed immediately and always kept alongside of the gun, preferably on the frame.
Okay. And what's rule number three?
Rule number three, always keep your firearms unloaded until you're ready to use them. So the moment you pick up a firearm, you have to make sure that if they have any manual safeties, they're engaged. Open up the action, remove the magazine, visually and physically inspect to make sure that there's no rounds in the chamber, and then you are ensured that the gun is empty.
Jose Morales, NRA training counselor, let's go over those three rules again. Number one.
Absolutely. Always keep the gun pointed in a safe direction. Number two is always keep your finger off of the trigger until you're ready to shoot. And number three is always keep the gun unloaded until you're ready to use it.
All right, the three rules of firearm safety. How can we get some more information about this?
Just check on nrainstructors.org for a comprehensive list of classes, and we'd love to see people take more of them.
Jose, why is it important that we observe these three rules of gun safety?
As I tell my students and gun enthusiasts and budding gun enthusiasts, guns are incredibly safe. We are the ones that are unsafe. We are the ones that make accidents happen. And if you follow all three safety rules all the time, not when you remember, not when you feel like it, but all the time, it is literally impossible to have an accident.
Speaking with Jacqueline Kelly with Armed in Heels. Jacqueline, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing so great. How are you doing?
I'm doing so well, and better now that you're here, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much.
You light up the set.
I'm glad here.
Tell us, what is Armed in Heels all about?
So Armed in Heels is an online retailer, and our goal is to support women who feel empowered and to feel empowered as they enter the shooting community. My husband and I started this company when he introduced me to firearms. I cried. I was terrified. I tried to go enter the industry to get more information and to engage and learn, but it was really intimidating for me. And so what we did is create Armed in Heels to support the working woman, the empowered women, the wife, the mother that wants to get engaged in a safe way.
Okay, so you said you went and tried it. You cried. You were terrified. Was that before or after your shot?
I think he took it out of the case. I cried. Oh. And then he put it away. And
I see.
It
okay.
maybe took 2 years to get the guts
really?
To do it again. And I don't want women to have that experience.
No way.
No. So my goal is to make sure that they have an opportunity to get into the industry in a way that really makes them feel empowered and supported and helps establish their identity further.
I think that's an awesome idea. So, Jacqueline, how do you do this?
So what we do is we very carefully target lots of products that are actually made for women. That does not mean pink. That does not mean colors. That means if I see tack pants, they better fit my curves and they better help me conceal the way I want. And holsters, the same thing. So we really go out, pressure the manufacturers, and get those products to our women so that they can have them and integrate them with part of their lifestyle.
Awesome. It seems you have it figured out. I love your approach. I love your idea.
Great.
So how can people get more information about Armed in Heels?
So we can go onto our website, which is www.armedinheels.com.
Right.
You can also visit us on Facebook at Armed in Heels. And we're certainly looking to bring a good voice out there, so we hope we can get lots of women to engage.
Keep up the good work. Jacqueline Kelly with Armed in Heels, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Your first source for Second Amendment news and information. It's NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Still to come on the program, we'll talk with Congressman Mike Kelly of Pennsylvania, Kurt Liske of the Iowa Firearms Coalition, Luke Rosiak with the Daily Caller. Right now, I want to welcome from Judicial Watch, Chris Farrell is with us. Chris, how are you doing today?
Doing well. Great to be out with you again.
Well, I appreciate you joining us on the program. I saw the headlines yesterday afternoon, and I thought rather than read secondhand what happened in court, let's just go straight to the horse's mouth here. So a Judicial Watch in federal court yesterday, this was a hearing before a federal judge. What was the issue specifically that the judge was deciding yesterday, Chris?
Whether to grant us discovery, which means our ability to take sworn depositions of government officials, Hillary Clinton and her associates. And I'm very happy to announce that we had a huge victory. The judge has granted us discovery, and we will move forward in the coming weeks to get people like Assistant Secretary of State Patrick Kennedy, Huma Abedin, and others, perhaps even Hillary Clinton herself, under oath, answering questions about what she was doing with her outlaw email server.
And one of the things you want to know is whether or not this was set up in order to avoid things like Freedom of Information Act requests and lawsuits that Judicial Watch, you guys have a lot of, I mean, you use this law a lot to try to discover what's going on with government, the idea being that maybe Hillary Clinton thought she could get around this law by having this private server.
That's exactly what you did. You know, this server was deliberately set up as an end run around all the established communications procedures in the government. No other cabinet secretary in the history of the country has ever done anything like this. So not only is it an attempt to thwart transparency laws, open records laws, but this was an enormous national security vulnerability. It's been documented now. There are legal findings. It's not even open to discussion. It's established as legal fact that she sent dozens and dozens of highly classified documents and records across an unsecured server and open them up to compromise to, you know, China, Russia, terrorist groups, any hacker. It was a wildly reckless act on her part.
Talking again with Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch. All right, so given the judge's decision yesterday, Chris, and I understand the judge was pretty harsh, actually, in talking about Hillary Clinton and what has gone on to date, correct?
He was. He was extremely frustrated. He spent months and months of listening to rope-a-dope, double talk, a lot of phony baloney language from the Justice Department. And he's very frustrated because he feels like he's being manipulated and played, you know, for a fool. As he's concerned that the American public, we have a right to know what was going on. That's our work. That's our State Department. This is not some, you know, medieval feudal prince or something. This is, you know, the operations of government. The American public has a right to know. And moreover, he asked a direct question of a Justice Department attorney in the courtroom. He said, who authorized this server to be set up this way? They couldn't answer. They couldn't tell him who it was.
Really?
So he blew his top. I mean, this is absurd. We've been in litigation now for a couple of years. This has been the subject of an FBI national security crime investigation. you know, statement after statement from various government officials in sworn declarations, and he asks a simple, straight-up question, who authorized them to do this? And they stand there like totem poles.
You know, and it's, Chris, I'm thinking back to Operation Fast and Furious and the attempts, again, to get the government to explain who actually came up with this program, right? Who actually authorized this program? And again, you know, you had these, you had so many government officials looking at each other, shrugging their shoulders. We don't know. It's as if everything is made by committee, or all of these decisions just sort of magically happen. But nowhere.
It's just that simple. And we need to talk about it, you know, using that kind of language, because frankly, that's what the facts are. You know, people are deliberately lying and obfuscating and confusing things, and they have an inability to answer basic interrogatives. And these are very articulate, intelligent people, highly educated.
Mm-hmm.
The only way they're not answering is if they're deliberately being deceptive.
So, so can this decision be appealed by the...
I mean, anything can be appealed, but the point is, you know, their resistance to very basic discovery, just establishing, you know, like I said, answering the basic interrogatives about this, I don't think will go very far. The judge has been very prudent, very judicious. He's established a very firm record upon which to base this this granting of discovery. And, you know, the only people who don't like to answer questions are people that normally are guilty, right? So the government is in a really very awkward position when they've admitted certain things in court, like they can't tell you who authorized the creation of the server, yet they're still objecting to discovery. They won't let anybody even ask the question under oath, right? They look – it's an incredibly bad position to be in.
Do you get the sense, Chris, and I hope this isn't an unfair question, but do you get the sense that, the Hillary team is trying to slow walk this past the election?
Of course they are. And there are political operatives in the Department of Justice and in the State Department who are doing everything they can to protect her. I mean, let's not, you know, let's call it what it is. This is an effort to insulate and protect Mrs. Clinton for political objectives. Now, there's some institutional embarrassment because the State Department itself has been embarrassed and compromised by this. They engaged in a reckless way. They let somebody violate all their security protocols. So, frankly, they look stupid. They look negligent. But beyond just institutional embarrassment, there's a higher effort being made by political operatives who are embedded in the government itself, who will do anything and everything to have Hillary Clinton be elected the next president.
Talking again with Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch. So, Chris, what do you think the chances are that we'll actually get these depositions before Election Day?
I think they're quite high. It's not going to happen in lightning time. It's not. You know, we're talking a matter of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But before all the electoral political considerations come up next fall, these depositions will be taken, and we will have government officials and perhaps Hillary Clinton herself or associates under oath answering questions.
Well, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program explaining what happened yesterday. Again, this is all independent of the FBI's investigation, right? I mean, this is...
Correct. This is our own civil litigation trying to get some accountability. You know, in one regard, I hate to say this, but it's true. We're the only game in town. I mean, nobody else is either out to lunch or doing a half-hearted effort. I can't imagine why Mr. Comey hasn't gone before the Attorney General and presented his case for prosecution or for indictment. I guess Loretta Lynch today in front of Congress said that everything's just taking its normal course.
Mm-hmm.
It's preposterous. You know, before I came to Judicial Watch, I was a special agent of Army Counterintelligence. I've run investigations like this. I've gone to prosecutors and had successful prosecutions. The notion they don't have enough evidence is preposterous.
Well, we will certainly see what happens here, Chris. I know that the story is not going to go away for Hillary Clinton or for the D.C.-based media. And I, again, appreciate you coming on the program. Hope we can talk again very soon, sir.
Great. Thanks very much.
You bet. Chris Farrell joined us from Judicial Watch here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Congressman Mike Kelly of Pennsylvania is coming up in just a little bit. We'll also talk next hour with Kurt Liske of the Iowa Firearms Coalition. Almost a half dozen pro-gun bills on the move in the state of Iowa. Luke Rosiak of the Daily Caller on a story that, again, this is one of those stories that should be on the nightly news. It should be in your local paper. I'm not saying it should be a front page story, but it's important enough that it should be covered. And I worry that stories like this don't get covered in the media environment that we have here. So what happens, again, when somebody screws up? And one of the members of the administrative state that we were talking about with Dean Reuter from Liberty's Nemesis, what happens when they get called out? When clearly mistakes were made, performance was subpar, and real lives were impacted. What actually happens? Is there accountability? Is there responsibility taken? Or is there a desire to just sort of make the issue, not the employee, go away? Because Luke found out that the former head of the VA in St. Louis, who again was responsible for running a hospital with the lowest patient satisfaction rating, potentially exposed 1,800 patients to HIV, and twice had the hospital closed for medical safety issues, didn't lose her job. Still drawing the same exact salary that she was drawing as the head of the VA system in St. Louis, Missouri. $160,000 a year. Only now she's living in a government-paid condo. How about that? In Manila, in the Philippines, running a clinic in the U.S. Embassy there. Now, Luke says the Manila VA office provides outpatient care and disability checks to the few surviving Filipino World War II veterans who fought alongside Americans against the Japanese. The occasional American veteran who happens to be in the country can also get outpatient care in the Manila VA facility. Back in 2011, the Government Accountability Office actually questioned whether or not this facility even needed to be open, given the, unfortunately, declining numbers of World War II veterans in the country. But it's still open. As a matter of fact, it's being run by somebody who was run out of town in St. Louis, Missouri. So, again, we'll talk with Luke Rosiak of the Daily Caller about that coming up in Hour 3. Also in Hour 3, we've got our hero of the day, our deal of the day, and our good guy of the day coming up. In Oregon, legislation that would limit, the Oregonian says, but to still allow firearm sales when background checks take longer than expected, barely cleared the Oregon House on Monday. Dennis Thrault of the Oregonian says that right now Oregon gun buyers can obtain firearms by default if a background check takes more than 3 days, a provision modeled after federal law. Anti-gun advocates who passed the universal background check bill last year in Oregon, over the objections of many of the county sheriffs there who said that this was unenforceable, that wasn't enough. That was not the end-all, be-all. Now they are back. Now their new bill says, well, we think that that should wait until 10 days. We should have a 10-day waiting period if there's not a response back from the NICS system. Go from 3 to 10. The vote in the House, 31 to 28. Now, the bill was actually watered down. The bill was introduced seeking a ban on sales in Oregon, making the firearm purchasers wait as long as it took for the check to finish. So if it was 10 days, it was 10 days. If it was 10 months, it was 10 months. If it never got completed for whatever reason, then you never purchase that firearm. In Oregon, by the way, it is the Oregon State Police conducting the checks. Representative Jeff Barker, according to the Oregonian, a former Portland police officer, insisted on 10 days before letting it out of the House Judiciary Committee. He said he thought a blanket ban on default sales went too far. He said at some point we need to have a cutoff date that's solid and doesn't require an innocent citizen to keep proving their innocence. 31-28, the vote. Oregonian said opponents of the measure noted the unusual circumstances that led the suspected killer in Charleston, South Carolina, to obtain his firearm. Clerical errors kept a investigator from learning within the three-day waiting period that the suspected shooter had disqualifying drug offenses. Republicans argue that no amount of extra time would have actually unearthed that mistake. The Oregonian also says that Representative Barker repeated a promise from the chief sponsor of House Bill 4147, the House Majority Leader, Jennifer Williamson, Democrat from Portland, that lawmakers would pour hundreds of thousands more dollars in the Oregon State Police budget to speed up background checks. All 25 House Republicans voting against the bill, joined by three Democrats as well. Deborah Boone of Cannon Beach, Katty McCown of Coos Bay, and Brad Witt of Clatskanie. Measure now heads to the state Senate. The governor, Kate Brown, has praised the measure. Senate Majority Leader Jenny Burdick, Democrat from Portland, said that she considered the original bill that would have simply denied the ability to purchase a firearm until that background check had come back. She called that a good policy. No word on what she thinks about the watered-down version, but I'm guessing she's still supporting it. So, again, we've got that happening in the state of Oregon right now. So it's a very busy time of year. And, again, in states all across the country, we are seeing a number of pro-gun bills, obviously a number of gun control bills being introduced as well in places like Oregon. But we are also seeing things like, again, permitless carry, heading to the governor's desk in West Virginia, campus carry, passing out of the House in Georgia, heading to the floor of the House in Tennessee, concealed carry reform measures and expansion measures passing in Wyoming. It's a very busy session this year. Hopefully, we'll be able to get you caught up with all of the latest segment news and information each and every day here on NRA News Cam and Company. And we're going to take a quick time out. When we return here, Congressman Mike Kelly of Pennsylvania will join us on the program. Coming up top of the hour, Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorps Defense, Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day. Stick around. We'll be right back with more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this. Well, we're here at the Strip Gun Club in Las Vegas, Nevada, and SHOT Show 2016 has not yet officially begun, but you guys are kicking it off anyway. Ron Bellin is here, our friend from Reaper Outdoors. Good to see you.
Good seeing you too, Cam. Thanks for coming out.
Yeah, absolutely. So what is this event here?
This is a very special event. We have several companies that actually came in, and the thing is, what we're doing is we're bringing veteran-owned, veteran families coming in and supporting these great things that we got: TNQ ammunition, Reaper Outdoors ammunition, Axis and Tactical. So it's a big event to just bring people out to see what we're doing and our charities as well.
So all of the companies that you just mentioned, these are veteran-owned, veteran-started, right? I mean, this is you and your friends, basically. You, Marcus, Jeff Axelson, Matt Axelson's brother, yep, running Axis and Tactical. I mean, these are the men who have gone and fought, basically, who are now coming back, and you guys are starting your own companies. I mean, it's really cool, Ron.
Yeah, it's a bunch of startups. I mean, even if, like Matt, you know, who died in 2005, you know, his family started Axis and Tactical. So, you know, there's a huge, huge movement right now with veterans being out there and doing good things for people and also building businesses. So we come together as a group. Marcus, obviously, is a great promoter and a, you know, a great American, big war hero. You know, he's a great guy and a great friend to me. So we just want to support each other, and I really appreciate that. And we definitely support the Axon family. They're just a great family. Got the Dietz family coming in this week as well. So we have a lot of activities happening. So we called this whole event just so we could have our own personal time here, let people see what we're doing. We have a lot of great people coming in that we invited, and it's been great so far.
So I've got to ask, because, you know, right now gun control supposedly is a big issue for Hillary Clinton. It's obviously a big issue for Barack Obama. I imagine that there are a lot of anti-gun activists out there who are scratching their heads saying, why would you, Ron Bell, and why would Marcus Luttrell, why would you guys want to, and why would Jeff Axelson want to create these modern battlefield weapons of war for sale for civilians? Can you talk about the rifles, the ammo, the products that you make, and why believe that these are part of our right to keep and bear arms?
Yeah, first off, we have this thing called Second Amendment. That is our history. This is our country. You know, we fought, we bled, we died for this country. And the veterans out there, every single one of you have done great things. We have fought for the Constitution, and the Second Amendment happens to be one of them, right? Can't take that away from us. Our country was founded on that. Not only that, these weapon systems that we have, these bullets that we have, and all the other products that circle around it, isn't just used to go out and kill people. That's not the intent. The intent, number one, is that you have that right to bear arms, period. And actually, you know, on top of that, it's not just to go hunting. It's to protect yourself, your family, and our way of life here in America. That's been a great deterrent throughout history. Not only a deterrent, but we should also have that right as individuals. We should have that right as Americans and being responsible to own weapons like this. We let 16-year-old children go out and literally drive a car. They kill more people every year than weapons do. Law-abiding citizens, when they buy a weapon, they register, they do exactly what they're supposed to do. They keep these weapons in a place where it should be safe, and they use them when they need to use them, and they use them how they're supposed to be used. So we developed this stuff not only for self-protection as well as our family, home, and our country, but also for hunting. We are in a huge thing right now where all us veterans have gotten back. We have great technology out there, and that's the whole point of this stuff. There's technology. There's an evolution that goes from the military side that rolls right into the hunting side. And that's what we're doing. We want to be the frontiersmen that bring these products out to the nation and out to everybody out there in America.
Well, you know, you mentioned hunting, so I got to ask you, how is Reaper Outdoors going? How's the TV show? It seems like you've been on the road a lot more than you've been home lately.
We have. I'll say that's weather bound. Everywhere we went this year, it was a little warmer year, you know, so the animals weren't moving as normal, but we stay out there, we do our thing, and we have a mission to do. You know, every time we go out there, we have to have a show. So we just hunt really hard. This has been a great year for us, not only on the hunting side. The television show is doing great. You know, we're moving to prime time on the Pursuit Channel, 9:30 Tuesdays, starting third and fourth quarter, which start in July. And on top of that, we actually are launching this year, right now, 2 days from now at SHOT Show, the Reaper line of ammunition, something that's a lead-free called Control Chaos. And it's great for hunting. It's great for home protection. And, you know, so we're launching that here and now.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Coming up top of the hour, hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy of the day. Right now, I want to welcome to the program Congressman from the great state of Pennsylvania, Representative Mike Kelly is with us. Congressman, how you doing, sir?
I'm really good, Cam. How are you?
I am fantastic. I appreciate you joining us on the program. Got to spend several days in the Harrisburg area recently at the Great American Outdoor Show and had a great time as always.
Always a good thing to participate in, I'll tell you. We have a lot of folks that really understand the Second Amendment, understand how much pressure we're under right now. And people ask me, so when are these things going to take place? I said, as soon as we stop paying attention. So, hey, Cam, what you're doing and NRA News is doing is absolutely essential for all of us as citizens of the United States, because we are working under a really heavy veil of secrecy by a president that is so determined to finish up his last several months in office with things that are going to have such unbelievable effects on the rest of us for such a long, long time. So, you know what? Thanks so much for what you're doing for our listeners. Folks, please pay attention to the other thing. We got to get out and vote. These people just didn't walk in and sit down. Every one of them got elected. That's the thing that's the stunning part of it.
Absolutely. Well, you know, listen, Congressman, you know, when we were up there in Harrisburg, we met a lot of folks from Western Pennsylvania, Western Maryland, West Virginia, coal country.
Yes.
And, you know, these folks are very concerned. A lot of them, they're hurting. I mean, just flat out. It's not, you know, a theoretical concern about what the Obama administration is doing with the coal industry. It is it's already affecting them. You, along with 170 members of Congress, 34 U.S. senators, submitted an amicus brief to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals yesterday talking about the state of West Virginia et al. Versus the Environmental Protection Agency. Now, this is dealing with that, again, that regulatory plan developed by the EPA,
right?
The Clean Power Plan. And why, Congressman, why on earth would members of Congress want to get in the way of what a regulatory agency like the EPA is trying to do? What do you think, you have like some sort of legislative authority to act here?
Yeah, I'll tell you the one thing I do know. We're going to use every lever available to us to try and call back some of these things that the executive branch has really run roughshod over the legislative branch. And, of course, famously, the president said, I don't need any of you folks because I've got a phone and a pen. He also has his whole alphabet soup of agencies that will try anything they can to reach levels that are stunning to all of us. And when you talk about coal country, you know, we're taking away generational families, communities, churches, schools. And this is, you know, I always hear, Cam, and you and I have talked about this before, the unintended consequences mm-hmm. of things that happen in Washington, D.C. I would just tell you on this one, these are totally intended consequences. The president was running for office. He said, if you want to continue to make electricity by burning coal, you can do that, but we'll bankrupt you. And that was one of the promises he certainly kept. Listen, what Congress does have is the ability of oversight, and we were able to get the amicus brief out. We were able to get the courts to look at it, and they put a stay in place. Okay, that's one part of the effort, but we've got to keep moving forward. And while we do have a lame duck president, the old saying, if it quacks like a duck and waddles like a duck, it's a duck. This is a duck, and this is one of the things we cannot duck our responsibility to any single American on 40% of the nation's electricity is produced by burning coal. And the coal we burn, I'm always surprised when people say, I don't understand how they burn those big chunks of coal. I said, have you ever seen what they burn? And I said, yeah, big chunks of coal. I said, no, it's like a talcum powder. It's the same kind of move forward. You know, I was in the automobile industry all my life. We burn gas, but the gas we burn is compressed in a cylinder and explodes. It's a vapor that actually explodes and causes the combustion inside that drives a piston. We make electricity the same way. This is a powder. This is a talcum. It's very clean. It's made so many headways. But the most important thing is it lights our home. It warms our home in the winter. It cools it in the summer. It keeps our cities safe. It keeps our factories running. And I think that we're really up against it right now. And as I said earlier, we need every single American to pay attention. Forget about how you're registered, okay? I'm an Irish Catholic. There was nobody in my family that thought they were Republican. They were all Democrats because they were working people and blue-collar people. You know what? We're all blue-collar people right now. We better make sure that we're making every effort to protect for the future what has been granted to us because of so many sacrifices in the past. So, listen, this is just one effort, Cam. I mean, you know that. I mean, there's just so many things that we have to keep an eye on. But this Clean Power Plan is incredible what the EPA has been able to do. But, again, Congress has a responsibility of oversight. We have to call these things out. We can investigate. We can expose. We can do certain things. But really, a lot of this comes down to elections. I get so upset when people tell me, you know what, somebody should have done something about it. And I said, well, you know what, if you vote, it would help. And people tell me, I don't vote. And I say, why not? Because my vote doesn't count. I said, oh, my God, if you don't vote, that's a true statement. Your vote doesn't count. But if we stop voting, if we stop having a voice in our government, if we allow people to do things to us and then sit back and commiserate over what happened to us, and then we said, but I don't get involved anymore, then shame on us. We can change it. We can change it at the polls. We can change it every time somebody runs for office. And I encourage anybody who's listened, Cam, if you think it's wrong, if you don't think it's right, be a candidate or go out and help a candidate that you have researched and you know exactly who they are. Everything we're looking at today is coming to pass. One man's legacy really is so important that we're going to put this country in such a position that we may not be able to recover in the future. This is absolutely stunning what we've allowed to happen to ourselves.
Well, and as you say, apathy doesn't get you anywhere. Actually, apathy will get you somewhere, but it's generally not where you want to be going. Right. Generally, apathy takes you down some bad roads. If you're not active, if you're not engaged, and frankly, I do think that this is the most important election that we have faced. And you can say that about every election. But, I think across the aisle, what you would hear Representative Kelly is people, Democrats and Republicans alike, who absolutely would say this is the most important election. When you look at sort of the stark contrasts in any number of areas, including our Second Amendment rights, you've got, it seems, a group of politicians who say the answer to make our country safer is to go after the legal law-abiding gun owners. Then you've got another group of politicians and voters who say, no, the answer to make our country safer is to go after the violent criminals committing these crimes. That's a pretty stark division and a pretty stark divide between those two points of view. And the battleground is the ballot box this year.
Absolutely. No, you stated so clearly. But again, Kim, we have these conversations, and I can tell people, listen, you can get upset, and you can throw a shoe at the television because you got worked up, and all you did was break your television. You may get it off your chest, but you haven't gotten it off your plate. The only way we are able to safeguard our future is by guaranteeing it that the people who represent us are truly who they say they are, and we force them. We make sure that whoever we vote for is a person who you can actually believe in and who you can trust. I hate to say this, but every single problem we have right now is a result of people we elected. They just didn't go in and sit down. They got elected. And I'm watching this, and I understood the first 4 years of the president's term. The second 4 years is astounding to me that America would sit back and say, listen, you know what? The other guy was much better. I think he could run the business better. But, gosh darn it, I think the other guy likes me better. And I said, when you define like, what do you mean by like? We've gone through such an unbelievable upheaval the last 7.23 years. And this was all by design. We are divided every way. We're divided by our faith. We're divided by our gender. We're divided by our ability to make a living. We're divided in so many ways right now. We're divided by color. These are things that I never thought I would see in America, but we've allowed it to happen. And sometimes, the old story is somebody that really knows how to speak, well, they can tell you to go to hell and you're looking forward to the journey. Well, I'd like to know right now, those people that were so entranced by this man's speech, how's the ride?
Talking again with Congressman Mike Kelly of Pennsylvania. Congressman, I got to ask you, what are you hearing from your constituents right now? Are you hearing anger? Are you hearing apathy? Are you hearing disgust and I'm fed up? Or are you hearing people who are willing to fight, who are not willing to give up?
You know what? All the above. But the last one that you talked about are people who are saying that they're willing to fight. You know, Cam, we've talked about this before. I'm a product of the greatest generation. When I look back at what my parents went through, I remember one time talking to my dad as an 89-year-old, and he was going over what had happened to him going through the Great Depression, mm-hmm. One of nine kids. They always had something to eat, but never too much to eat. The only person that ever got a new shirt, new shoes, new pants was his oldest brother. They all got the chance to wear it on the way down the line. And they got to fight in World War II. They got to bring the whole world back into shape. And I said to my dad one time, and he was talking about this, we're riding along, and I said, my God, Dad, it had to really be hard. How did you do it? This is an 89-year-old man who started his own business, almost went broke a couple times, survived those near-death experiences, became stronger for it. He looked across at me and said, son, what did you just ask me? I said, well, Dad, you told me how hard it was for you and growing up with Mom and Pop Kelly and how hard it was for Pop to put food on the table, and then you and Mom starting this dealership and how hard it was for you. How did you get through it? This guy looked across at me, Cam. You know what he said to me? Damn it, it wasn't an option. We had to. So I just tell my friends right now that tell me, how are we going to get through this? It's not an option. It's fallen on our watch. It's fallen to our generation. We don't have an option on this. You may be upset. You may be angry, but get active. People are fed up with traditional politicians who worry more about getting elected than getting the country fixed. And too often, we point to things we couldn't get done because an election was in the way. My God, if you can't tell the truth and articulate it, then what the hell are you doing in office?
Congressman Mike Kelly, it is always a pleasure talking with you, sir. We appreciate your time, and hope we get a chance to do this again very soon.
I hope so. Hey, you know what, Cam? Please, what you do is phenomenal. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. And to our listeners, This is our country. This is our time. This is our fight. And we'll be damned if we're walking away from it.
Congressman, as always, a pleasure, sir.
Thank you, Cam.
Thank you. Mike Kelly, Republican from Pennsylvania, joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. You know, I was also talking with my 89-year-old father not long ago and talking about my my dad, who was also in World War II as a young man, came back, used the GI Bill to help put him through college, didn't pay for everything. He also drove a truck nights and weekends while he was going to school full-time, got married, had a kid while he was in college. And, you know, that was not unusual. That was sort of the norm to have made those sacrifices, to have gone through things that, frankly, most of us cannot even fathom. No matter how many documentaries we may watch on the History Channel, no matter how many movies Hollywood might put out about the Greatest Generation, unless we live through it, we can't really fathom the sacrifice that those men and women made, and the fight, not just the sacrifice, the fight that they put up to keep this nation a free country, to keep those liberties intact for their kids, who, yes, turned out to be the baby boomers, and some of them decided that, nah, those rights aren't really all that important. Other members of that generation, though, carried that fight forward. But you talk to those, again, those members of that Greatest Generation, and there aren't as many of them left as there used to be, and they are passing by the day. And you'll hear, again, a sentiment very similar to what Congressman Kelly's dad said. How'd you do it? What do you mean, how do we do it? We had to do it. There was no other option. We just got it done. All right, stick around. Hour 3 of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, is coming up with the Hero of the Day, Deal of the Day, and more right after this quick timeout. Right now, I want to welcome to the program Jason Redman from Combat Wounded Coalition. And, you know, obviously we've had Jason on the program as well talking about his book. Jason, how are you, sir?
I am awesome. I mean, obviously I'm out here at SHOT Show. You're in Vegas. You're with just amazing patriots who love this country, the Second Amendment. They love freedom. And you know me, that's all the things that I stand for.
Absolutely. And so you are out there. You're not just seeing the sights. I mean, you've got a product that you are showing off at SHOT Show this year, right?
That's right. We are pretty excited. So I have partnered with Miltac Knife and Tool Company. They are a great company based out of Texas. And they've been a huge supporter of Wounded Warriors, Special Operations Wounded Warrior, and they support us, Combat Wounded Coalition and Wounded Wear. And, you know, we just started talking, and I have always been a huge fan of edged weapons, of knives. And Craig Sword, the head of Miltac, said, hey, Jay, what do you think about making a knife for yourself, the Jason Redman Overcome Knife? And that was probably about 6 months ago, and it led to this amazing product right here, which this is the first prototype. This is the unveiling today. But this knife captures my life, and it was based off the idea. You've got the Tanto blades, which carries us back to the original samurai, you know, that warrior spirit. This knife is also similar, many aspects of it, to what I carried when I was wounded. It is designed for, you can use it with fighting, you know, the fighting pommel, single tang, single piece of metal, so great strength, great versatility. It can be a good fighting knife. It can be a good field knife. And the red and black actually represents the aspects of my life. Those who have read my book, The Forging and Reforging, know that the forging part was when I was a young, new leader, made some mistakes, almost ended my career, and had to dig myself out of that hole. So the black paracord represents that that period, the original forging. Of course, the red represents the blood I shed on the battlefield and the blood that so many other warriors have shed. And so that is the forging and reforging. Of course, having the JR Overcome logo on it. So this nice of it is for anybody that has that mindset that I can overcome adversity. I tell you, working with Miltac a couple of years ago, I did a hog hunt. I used one of their knives, very similar to this, and I took down I got a boar. Anybody that's never done that before, hunting wild boar with dogs and knives, it was amazing. But their knife, it did the trick. It was fast. It was efficient. And that boar was down quickly.
That is awesome. Our friend Ron Bellin invited me, actually, to go on a hog hunt that way. And, unfortunately, I had to pass up the opportunity, but I hope to go at some point because it sounded like no hunt that I've ever heard of before, Jason. I mean, it sounded like you are really getting back to. I mean, you're getting awfully primal when you're hunting hogs with knives and dogs.
You are, and you just get caught up in the energy. I'll be honest, it's one of the few things, maybe next to skydiving, that brings back that. That adrenaline rush that you would get when you were in combat before you would go into a building or before you were taking something down. I mean, the dogs start, you know, they catch scent of that boar, they go after it, and you're just running through the woods trying to go after these boars. The dogs try and pin it, and you go in with the knife. So all of this coming back together with the idea of creating that Overcome knife, you know, for a guy like me who got severely wounded, got put back together. You know, all of you know my motto, my mantra is overcome. It is what that's what I talk about. So pretty neat to work with Miltac and come full circle and now have this knife.
Welcome back. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program this hour, Kurt Liske of the Iowa Firearms Coalition, Luke Rosiak of the Daily Caller, joining us, plus the Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day. I apologize if I'm a little distracted here. We've got a tornado warning in Farmville right now. Just talked to my wife in a tornado little too close for comfort to my house at the moment. So the next 15 minutes or so of the show, I might be a little distracted until I'm able to talk with my wife. As somebody who lived in Oklahoma, covered storms in Oklahoma and in Arkansas. Not a huge fan of tornadoes, and we'll just have to keep our eyes on things. I think we'll be all right here in the Farmville studio, but we'll let you know. If you hear sirens in the distance and you see me take off, that's what's going on. All right, in the meantime, let's get to the Hero of the Day. We'll start with the Hero, actually, sponsored by AdCorp Defense. I've got a couple of stories for you, updates from court. First, the Toledo Blade reporting on a robbery suspect who was in court. 21-year-old Jordan Winfrey found guilty by the Lucas County Common Pleas Judge Linda Jennings of robbery, pleaded no contest, faces up to 3 years. Yep, that's it, 3 years. When he is sentenced on March the 9th, Winfrey was shot last May 25th when he tried to rob Stephen Darrington, who was legally carrying a firearm. And now the 21-year-old pleading no contest to robbery and facing 3 years behind bars. In Hickory, North Carolina, the Hickory Record reporting on another individual who tried to burgle a home, who's in court after an armed citizen shot the would-be burglar. He was released from the Frye Regional Medical Center and arrested on a warrant Monday morning, shot twice by the homeowner during the incident back on February 15th, according to Hickory Police spokesperson Crystal Dieter. 36-year-old Brian Foster Eckerd, charged with one felony count of first-degree burglary. The homeowner, Anthony Tony Pitts, age 71, said a man kicked in the glass back door to Pitts' home. Fit shot at the man three times, hit at him twice. Suspect found nearly a mile away, taken again to the local medical center. The homeowner in the case, not injured in the attack, didn't know the intruder, according to a police report. Tony Pitt says, I felt like I was about to have a heart attack. I didn't want to do this, but I had to. You know, again, here we have another gun owner who did not wake up and think to himself, I hope today's the day I get to use my gun in self-defense. Because gun owners don't really think that. Any more than you think, if you're a non-gun owner, I really hope I get to use the fire extinguisher in my kitchen today. Right? Any more than we think when we get behind the wheel of our car, I hope I get to test out how good my insurance policy is. I hope I get just slammed into by another vehicle. No. We think about these things when we have to rely on our fire extinguisher, and we're glad we have it. We're glad it's there. We're glad that we have insurance. Tony Pitts was glad that he had his firearm there. He didn't want to be in that position. He didn't want to have to defend his life with a firearm. But he didn't want a stranger breaking through his back door either. Eckerd requested a court-appointed attorney. Also verbally requested a bond reduction. Judge denied this request, saying that such a request must be made in writing. The judge also advised Mr. Eckerd that a guilty verdict on the charge could result in a maximum sentence of 17 years in prison. Right now, Mr. Eckerd is being held in the Catawba County Jail on a $20,000 bond. Our deal of the day from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Also, looks like maybe dealing with some armed citizen situations here in Tulsa. But News on 6 in Tulsa, Oklahoma says Tulsa police released the names of two men killed after allegedly breaking into Tulsa homes last Thursday and Friday morning. Police Sergeant Dave Walker says a 31-year-old man shot and killed inside a home early Thursday has been identified as Eric Coulter. Oklahoma Department of Corrections records show that Coulter was released from prison in March of 2014 after serving time on a drug possession conviction out of Tulsa County. Friday morning, a homeowner shot and killed a 22-year-old man during a home invasion. That suspect identified as Devin Sanders. Department of Corrections records show that Sanders was actually released from prison a little more than 2 months ago, December of 2015. After serving time, don't say how much time, but serving time on a burglary conviction out of Tulsa County. Sergeant Dave Walker with the Tulsa police says both cases still being investigated, but it appears that both Coulter and Sanders were both armed with handguns and breaking into homes that they did not live in. And Devon Sanders, our deal of the day. Now, our good guy of the day. I told you we're going to talk with Luke Rosiak of the Daily Caller coming up a little bit later on in the hour about a VA scandal that really hasn't gotten a lot of coverage. The former head of the St. Louis VA hospital system removed from her job after 1,800 patients may have been exposed to HIV, after the facility had to be shut down twice for safety concerns, after the hospital had the lowest patient satisfaction rating in the VA system. But again, this is not to say that everybody involved in the VA is trying to game the system. We know that's not the case. I've talked with plenty of veterans who are constantly praising the healthcare providers within the VA system. And as a matter of fact, our good guy story from Channel 12, KFVS in Marion, Illinois. Walter Vernell Holderfield, he is a Marine Corps veteran, and he is dying. He has a terminal illness. Doctors don't know how much longer he has. KFES says he suffers from a terminal respiratory condition, which could claim his life within months. So they're talking about a matter of months now, not a matter of years for Walter. One of his final wishes, Walter Holderfield, he liked his motorcycles. But it is, it's been a few years since he's been on a motorcycle, and he wanted to go for one last ride. So Friday of last week, VA employees, veterans, got together with Walter Holderfield, and he went on his ride. More than 200 bikers and veterans joining Walter for that last ride. Seeger Guru was one of the hundreds of people who showed up, not on the back of a bike, but on the sidewalks there in Marion, Illinois, to cheer him on. And he said there's something special about someone getting to do their last wish, just being able to do what they love, whatever that is. His was getting on a motorcycle, so it was awesome to see him do that. And Walter Holderfield said, quote, "I'm very thankful." He said, "I'm thankful for the VA and everybody here for making this possible. That's what the main thing is," he said, "them making it happen for me." Two nurses there at the VA actually started the organizing of this event after Mr. Holderfield told them how much he missed being able to ride. Those nurses, according to KFES, also gave Walter Holderfield a handmade biker's keychain. Mr. Holderfield said he loved it so much that he requested to be buried with it. So to all of those in Marion, Illinois, the staff there at the VA hospital, the veterans in the area, and the members of the community who simply wanted to turn out and cheer on a veteran as he made that final ride, thank you. Thank you all for being some of the many, many good guys out there. And when you see a story like that, and you see the care and concern and compassion and community that is present within the VA system, it really bugs you a little more to hear about somebody who was removed from their position, but not fired from the government, not canned from the system, just sent somewhere else. But we'll talk about it again with Luke Rosiak of the Daily Caller later on in the hour. Kurt Liske, again, of the Iowa Firearms Coalition, on the number of pro-gun bills that are on the move in Iowa, almost half a dozen pro-gun bills on the move in the state of Iowa, and that is very, very good news to hear. Hopefully, we will see these measures get to the governor's desk there in the state of Iowa. Now, before we take our first time out of the hour, there's a opinion piece from the Flint Journal News leader, Brian Mickle, who says it is time to ban gun sales. This is the actual headline: "Time to ban gun sales until we find a way to keep them out of the wrong hands." And he wonders, where was the good guy with the gun when an Uber driver shot and killed six people in Kalamazoo on Saturday night? He says, where was the good guy with the gun when a mentally unstable man shot a Bay City cop Friday before turning the gun on himself? And where are the good guys with guns, he says, when the estimated 30-some people are slain by firearms every day in America? Nowhere to be found, Brian Mickle writes. And why, he says? Mickle says, because there are more bad guys with guns doing wrong than there are civilian good guys with guns trying to stop them. And he says, so how about this? An immediate ban on handgun sales until America gets its gun problem sorted out. Even the gun nuts, he says, should be able to get by on 300 million guns until we find a solution to this epidemic of senseless death. Now, again, I realize this is an opinion piece. This is not a news story. But there are some facts that Brian Mickle just gets wrong. First, let's start with that sentence. Because there are more bad guys with guns doing wrong than there are civilian good guys with guns trying to stop them. That's not true in the state of Michigan, and it's not true for the country overall. We have around 300 million privately owned firearms, maybe closer to four at this point, 400 million. But we have about 13 million concealed carry holders. We have about 90 million gun owners in this country, but about 13 million have their concealed carry license. In the state of Michigan, it's now over 500,000 individuals. In the state of Michigan, in 2014, there were a total of 42,348 violent crimes. There were 500,000 concealed carry holders. So, no, there actually are more good people, more law-abiding gun owners, than there are violent criminals. It does not, however, mean that every violent crime is going to be able to be thwarted by a concealed carry holder. Right? But Brian Mickle, who wonders where was the good guy with a gun to stop that Uber driver in Kalamazoo, Michigan? Where was the good guy with a gun when a mentally unstable man shot a cop in Bay City, Michigan? He doesn't ask, where was the good guy with a gun in Warren, Michigan, to stop that woman from stabbing her mom to death? Because there was a good guy with a gun there. He was actually honored by the city of Warren this week. But because he doesn't fit the narrative, Brian Mickle doesn't mention him. Brian Mickle of the Flint Journal News Leader says, how about this, an immediate ban on handgun sales until America gets its gun problem sorted out. Even the gun nuts, he says, should be able to get by on 300 million guns until we find a solution to this epidemic. We talked about this on yesterday's program. The total number of homicides in Michigan in 2014, these are not just gun-related homicides, these are all homicides. 535 homicides in Michigan in 2014. It's a lot, but it is also the lowest number of homicides that the state of Michigan has seen since 1966, when there were 415. And since then, on a fairly regular basis throughout the 70s and the 80s and into the 90s, the state of Michigan topped more than 1,000 homicides a year. The peak came in 1974, when there were 1,186 homicides. Again, in 2014, there were 535. So Michigan is becoming a less violent state, which is typically not what happens in an epidemic. An epidemic, something is growing out of control, right? Not actually diminishing in its frequency. But you know what else we had in Michigan? Since Mr. Mickle says, listen, we've got these crimes. We can't figure out what to do to stop these crimes. So we have to ban the sale of handguns to law-abiding, lawful people until we can figure out what to do about people who are committing crimes. In the state of Michigan, in 2014, there were over 1,500 drug overdose deaths. Many of them opioid-based prescription overdoses. Over 1,500. Around 1,500. About three times the number of all of the homicides in the state of Michigan. Now, is Brian Mickle going to say, you know what, we need to ban the prescription of these types of medications until we can figure out how to stop people from overdosing on these medicines? We need to ban prescribing these pills until we can figure out how to stop people who may get off of these pills from turning to heroin? No. I don't think Mr. Mickle has made that argument. In 2014, in the state of Michigan, there were around 900 traffic fatalities. And the number appeared to be going up last year in 2015, from what I could tell from news reports. Did Brian Mickle write an opinion piece saying, you know what, maybe we just need to suspend the issuance of driver's licenses until we figure out what to do here about the growing number, again, the increasing number of traffic fatalities. No, he did not. Why? I'm guessing because Brian Mickle thinks that's not the right way to address traffic fatalities. I'm guessing it's because Brian Mickle doesn't think that the right thing to do to address drug overdoses would be to ban the prescribing of opioid-based pain medication. I'm pretty sure Brian Mickle has a driver's license, probably has a car, might know someone who is on pain medicine, maybe doesn't want to see them in pain. But I highly doubt that Brian Mickle owns a firearm. So I think it's easier for Brian Mickle to say, you know what? It's not going to impact me. Let's just stop the sale of handguns right now until we can figure out how to stop people from using them in crimes. And we got to do something about this epidemic. Because I'm guessing this doesn't, his proposal wouldn't actually impact Brian in any way, shape, or form. Might not impact anybody that Brian knows. But when you try to, again, use that same argument that Brian Mickle is making here for other areas in the state of Michigan that have led to the deaths of more Michigan residents, I don't think he would be on board with that. Brian Mickle says, we need to stop wrapping ourselves in the Second Amendment and own up to the fact that our gun problem is getting worse and will only continue to get worse until we deal with it. Well, again, in the state of Michigan, violent crime is going down. And it has been for quite some time. Not only were the 535 homicides, all homicides, again, in the state of Michigan, the lowest since 1966, but the number of violent crimes in the state of Michigan, 42,348, the lowest since 1968. Again, this is good news. Is it not? That violent crime in Michigan at its lowest levels in over 40 years, I would think that would be good news. But I guess if your attitude is really, it's always time to ban the guns, then that's the argument that you're going to make. I got to say, I found the reasoning and the logic for this proposal to be a little lacking there from Brian Mickle. All right, when we come back after a quick timeout, Kurt Liske of the Iowa Firearms Coalition joins us. Luke Rosiak of the Daily Caller. After a quick break, stick around. We have more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Chris Midgett with the Firearms Guide. Chris, you've got a really exciting, neat product. Tell folks, what is the Firearms Guide?
Firearms Guide is a huge firearms, air guns, and ammunition searchable guide or a reference guide that it's online. Web address is firearmsguide.com. It's a subscription-only website, but it's not only a website. It's a huge searchable firearms and ammunition reference guide that it has its own search engine built inside of it, so all the users can actually search all these guns by the 14 different search criteria, by caliber, by country of origin, by year of production, by the type of the gun. Do I want to check rifle over shotgun? Do I want to check semi-automatic shotgun over and under shotgun, side-by-side shotgun, or maybe lever-action shotgun?
Wow, that's impressive. So So how did this come about? It sounds like a really neat resource to have.
Yes, we've been developing this for over 8 years. We published 5 previous editions on DVDs, and this 6th newest edition will not be published on DVD. We actually just publish it online in the form of searchable database.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So who's the kind of person, Chris, that would use the Firearms Guide? Give me a typical customer.
You know what? Typical customer is any gun enthusiast. Let me say that you're looking for a new concealed carry pistol. How are you going to find? You cannot Google these things. You cannot put in a Google, please show me concealed carry pistol. You press search and you get 65,000 websites. With us, you go to Firearms Guide. First click, you click on hangers. Then you choose caliber. For example, let me say 380. Then after that, you choose barrel length, because barrel length is
right.
Also one of the search criteria. So you choose something small, like 3-inch barrel length.
Right.
You want your concealed carry pistol to be light. So you choose frame material instead of steel. Let me say, let it be polymer.
All right, before we run out of time, how do you get more information about it?
Please go to firearmsguide.com. Everything is there.
Firearmsguide.com. Thanks, Chris. Thanks for being on the NRE News.
Thank you very much. Keep good work.
Speaking with Mike Christensen with Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Mike, welcome back to NRA News. You've got something neat going on for the new year, the 2016 Gun a Week drawing. What is it all about?
John, this is one of our big fundraisers for the year. Beginning the first Wednesday in March, we're going to give away a gun every week for 52 weeks. At the end of those 52 weeks, everybody who didn't win a gun will go into a drawing. And then we also take all of the winners and put them in a drawing, so somebody is guaranteed to win two guns out of this drawing.
Two guns. That sounds like a good deal. So this is for Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Let's tell folks what it is that you guys do.
John, we're working to give kids who don't have a chance to get outdoors that opportunity. We're taking kids who are served by organizations like Big Brothers and Big Sisters and other youth mentoring organizations, an opportunity to get out, learn to hunt and fish and shoot, and enjoy the great outdoors that we all know and love.
That is so awesome. So how do folks get involved in this drawing?
They can go to outdoormentors.org and click on the Gun a Week drawing link on the front page and get signed up right there.
That is so good. Before we run out of time, once again, it's a 2016 Gun a Week drawing. Tickets are available now. Start drawing first Wednesday in March. And Mike, I got about 30 seconds left. Tell folks why it's so important to get involved with an organization like yours. Why do you do what you do?
There are too many kids today who are never going to have a chance to go hunting and fishing unless those of us who love the outdoors step up and make that happen. And that's what outdoor mentoring is all about.
All right. Once again, it's the 2016 Gun a Week drawing. Tickets available now. How do folks get those tickets again, Mike?
Outdoormentors.org. Click on the link right there on the front page.
All right. So you're starting the drawing first Wednesday in March. Go there now and get information and find out more information about this great group, Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Mike Christensen, thank you, sir, for what you do, and thank you for being on NRA News. You have a good one.
Welcome back to NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Still to come, Luke Rosiak of the Daily Caller. I did check in during the break, and I think the worst of the storm has passed. A lot of hail, a lot of high winds, but I don't think a tornado at our place. So everybody is safe and sound. We'll keep our fingers crossed, and I'll use my knock on wood that hopefully that is the case for anybody out there dealing with these storms here on the Mid-Atlantic today. I want to welcome to the program right now from the Iowa Firearms Coalition, Mr. Kurt Liske. Kurt, how you doing, sir?
Cam, it's great to be on. I'm doing well. Thanks for having us.
You bet. Glad to have you back with us. And it looks like Iowa is one of the many states out there around the country where we are seeing a very busy legislative session in terms of Second Amendment-related bills.
Yeah, we had a phenomenal day yesterday in the Iowa House of Representatives. We had five pro-gun owner bills pass through with ease, with bipartisan support. There's a few folks on the opposition side who, tried to make a stink about it. But, no, we had a very remarkable day yesterday.
That's great. Well, let's talk about these bills then, Kurt, can we?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
You've
probably got the updated list in terms of the big priorities. So, Where do you want to start?
Yeah, well, I can give you the laundry list, and we can talk about them more specifically if you like. But so yesterday we had, like I said, five bills that passed out of the Iowa House of Representatives. The first one was it repeals the restriction on youth handgun shooting under adult supervision in Iowa. We've deemed it the Youth Safety and Parental Rights Act. After that, we had the Emergency Protection Act, which would guarantee the Second Amendment rights of Iowans during a state of emergency. This is a pretty direct spinoff of the New Orleans Hurricane Katrina situation we had, about 10 years ago or so. Then we also have the ATV Carry Act, which if you're an Iowan and you have your permit to carry, you can carry in your car, your truck, on a motorcycle, in a tractor, but for some reason off-road vehicles was left out. So even if you have your permit, you cannot carry. This would clean that up and bring that in line with the rest of the carry laws in the state of Iowa. Then we have the Hearing Protection Act, which would legalize suppressors. We've been working on that for a couple of years now. And then the final one is our Privacy Protection Act, which takes all that information that is on your permit to carry, if you're an Iowa resident or if you have a permit to acquire, which is what we have here as well. Right now, all of that information, you know, name, address, date of birth, all that stuff, is fair game for public record searches. We've had newspapers in the state of Iowa just do a big data collection, basically, and then publish the names of all the, you know, permit to carry, permit to acquire holders in the state of Iowa just on public record, just like they would do for a criminal or somebody else like that, and yet these people have done nothing wrong. This bill would make that so that is not the case. So that's the overview as far as what's advanced and what has now been passed over to the Senate. And Cam, I don't know if you have any specific questions. I'll be more than happy to go into more detail if you like.
Sure. Well, first of all, let's talk about the votes here, Kurt. Were these contentious bills? Were some of them less contentious than others? Do we have bipartisan support for these measures?
Yeah, bipartisan support on all five of them. And not bipartisan support in the sense that, hey, we had all of one party and we mm-hmm. picked up one or two members of the other. This is, you know, a pretty significant number of Democrats supporting this, breaking ranks from their caucus or other members of their caucus, I guess you could say, and unanimous support on the right side of the aisle with the Republican Party within the Iowa House of Representatives. So, yeah, like I said, bipartisan support and truly remarkable bipartisan support is at that. To answer your initial question, you know, were some of the bills more contentious than others? You know, all of these had pretty wide margins. I mean, the closest one as far as vote totals go was the that age restriction one, and that was 62 to 36. So, like I said, that, and that's the closest
wow.
out of all five. I have to note, just because it just absolutely made my day, that privacy protection bill passed 97 to 1 yesterday out of the Iowa House. As close to unanimous as you could get, and the guy that voted against it said he did it just on principle because he doesn't think a bill should ever be voted out unanimously. So, it was it makes you roll your eyes, but at the same time, you know what? If 97 to 1 is still a win by no small margin.
Oh, absolutely so. Right. And you know, as you say, I mean, if the closest vote was 62 to 36, Kurt, that's really not all that close, honestly.
Yeah.
That's yes. great news to hear because you know, I think, and we say this on the program all the time, and I actually mean it. Our Second Amendment is not a Republican right, even though at the federal level it might seem it might be that we have more Republicans than Democrats who are supporting Second Amendment measures. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of gun-owning Democrats in this country. There are a lot of gun-owning independents in this country. It is your right as an American to keep and bear arms, not your right as a member of a political party. And I think our rights are best protected, again, when we have that bipartisan support.
You got it, Cam. You and I are in lockstep, and as well as the rest of the IFC leadership. I mean, we go out of our way to remind our membership of that. You know, I mean, we'll work with anybody. If you're good on the Second Amendment, that's fine. I mean, we are a single issue advocacy group, and we are very fortunate, particularly in the Iowa House, to have a number of Democrats who, you know, feel strongly about these issues. And are willing to, like I said, break rank, so to speak. I mean, we have a very good working relationship with a number of them, and we are building more and more of those types of relationships in the Iowa Senate as well.
That's fantastic. Now, I'm looking at here a story from the Gazette in Iowa. They quote the executive director of the group Iowans for Gun Safety, mm-hmm. Jeremy Brigham, who said, quote, "The need to regulate guns is paramount. How can we be safer in a society," he said, "where there are as many guns as people?" So, Kurt, I've got to ask you, is Iowa getting more dangerous? is it becoming the Wild West here?
No, and it's funny because, you know, we were the ones who worked hand-in-hand with the NRA back in 2010 to go from may issue to shall issue for our permit to carry weapons laws in the state of Iowa. And, you know, at the time we heard all of the cliches. It's going to be the Wild West. There's going to be blood in the streets. There's going to be shootouts you know, over road rage and parking lots, and you know, somebody stole my spot at the mall, and here we are 6 years now, and there's been nothing of the sort, and this is just the same old line of thinking that just keeps getting regurgitated, and the issue changes as far as the bills that are put forward, but yet it's the same rhetoric every time, year after year. It's just that, hey, we're applying it to a different bill or, you know, a different issue that we are trying to put forward and make right that would, you know, protect and enhance the rights of you know, all 3 million Iowans. So quite honestly, to hear that and to see that quote, I guess the nicest way to put it is I'm not surprised in the least bit. So.
he also called it a crazy thing. What a crazy thing, he said. To allow snowmobile and ATV operators to carry firearms, citing safety concerns about guns accidentally discharging. He also talked about the suppressor bill. I guess this was another individual from Iowans for Gun Safety who sure. said it's very concerning from the standpoint in terms of scenarios you can picture in your head. That's an actual quote there, Kurt.
It's funny, my colleague, Barry Snell, president of the Iowa Firearms Coalition, we obviously work very closely together, and we actually talk about this from time to time in that, you know, the people that oppose these types of things, that is a rationale that we hear so often, and I'm sure you see it as well too, Cam, and anybody that's plugged into these issues, in that, well, you know, we all have bad days is something we hear, and you know, we all think bad thoughts, and what would we do if we had guns on those bad days? And, you know, it's people projecting their inner monologue on others, and yet they're ignoring the fact that there are literally tens of millions of Americans across this country, let alone just here in the state of Iowa, you know, that are responsible gun owners. And, yeah, you know what, we have bad days just like everybody else. Just because we're gun owners doesn't make us a liability, you know. Just because we're trying to maintain this level of freedom or perhaps even restore, you know, the liberties of the people of Iowa to an increased level, they think for some reason because they have these bad thoughts that all of a sudden they're projecting those on everybody else. And it's you just have to laugh at it after a while because, I mean, if you stew on it too much, it'd just make you crazy.
Absolutely. So, Kurt, what should Iowa gun owners be doing right now? Thanking their House members, perhaps, right? But
yeah, and actually, I'm actually working on the list this evening. I plan to sit down once I get my kids in bed, but hammering out the list of, hey, these are the people that are on the good guys list. They all voted for, you know, bills 1 through 5. These are the folks that didn't, just for, you know, just to make, you know, for the public record, so to speak. We'll be providing information as far as how to contact those folks. Just like always, we absolutely encourage people to thank those reps that, you know, that were good on the issues yesterday. And if somebody wants to reach out to those that opposed it, we just ask that they do that in a adult-like and respectful manner. But as far as, you know, moving forward, we're extremely thankful for the action out of the House. And now, you know, this is where we start applying the full court press, to use the basketball cliche, is the Iowa Senate. This is where the heavy lifting is. And we are going to be putting together, we call them our advocacy campaigns. It's just a quick, easy email tool that you can send. You basically put in your name and address, and it goes directly to your legislator, your senator specifically. We're developing talking points for guys to get out. We encourage them by all means possible if they can get out and meet their legislators face to face. We're very fortunate here in the state of Iowa. Almost every legislator holds, you know, public access things on a weekly basis, you know, whether it's just a coffee meet and greet or a forum or things like that. So we're doing our best to make it as easy for guys to, you know, have the words there in front of them, you know, so that they do get tongue-tied, know when and where to be there, all those sorts of things. Yeah, like I said, this is when the heavy lifting begins, and we truly need all hands on deck as far as what we've got going here in the state of Iowa.
Well, you had me at heavy lifting, Kurt. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir, and I hope we can talk again very soon.
I do, too. I really enjoy this. Thanks, Cam.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Kurt Liske joins from the Iowa Firearms Coalition here on NRA News, Cam and Company. When we return, Luke Rosiak of the Daily Caller is going to join us. We'll talk about what happens when a member of the administration fails to do their job. Do they get fired? Do they become an example to the rest of the administrative state? No, doesn't look like that's the case at all, as a matter of fact. Stick around. We've got more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this. Earlier today, there was a presentation from America's First Freedom, and give me a little backstory, JR. You knew that you were going to be there, right? But you didn't know what exactly this event was going to be, did you?
Yeah, basically, I was just told there was going to be some presentation, something that obviously involved a gun, and you know, that was basically the only info I had. Which, you know, after covering quite a few things for the NRA, I've had to go do stories where I had even less to go on. So, you know, I didn't think anything unusual of it. And sometimes you're just told, yeah, there's a story that involves guns. It's in Quantico. Go, you know. So, you know, hey, it's not a big thing. I had a little more guidance here. So I just figured, yeah, there's going to be a presentation. Somebody's getting a gun. And that's about all the info I had.
And so you show up. And what happened, JR?
So I show up, and there's all the builders and these wonderful people who have come together to that have built this custom rifle. And next thing I know, there's Chris Cox, and he starts talking about me, and I'm like, okay, what is going on here? This is not about me. This is not why I do this. It's not why I served. But so basically what happened is all these guys came together, and they created this amazing rifle. For me, left-handed, you know, 308, you know, there's too much stuff on it for me to even sit here and list, but it's just this amazing rifle that they put together, and they had done it in secret, behind my back, didn't tell me, and Chris Cox presented it to me, and I'm blown away. I'm still blown away. I'm looking at this rifle here in front of me, and I'm going, is that really mine, you know? Because that's one of those things any warrior, especially gun guy like me, wants something like this.
Right.
You know, you just realize it's probably not attainable, but these guys made it happen, and, you know, I'm forever grateful for that.
Well, listen, I think that we had a chance to talk with Mark Chestnut yesterday, and he kind of let me know what was going on, and I think everybody there at America's First Freedom was just so happy and honored that they could do something like this, because, you know, JR, and I think that you understand this as well, this is about more than just you. This is, you know, I think a small way of showing our appreciation and, you know, the folks from America's First Freedom's appreciation for everything that you've done for this country and everything that our military continues to do and the men and women of our military continue to do.
Yeah, you know, one thing that I've tried to do, you know, people like to sit and list off my accomplishments, and, you know, that's all fine and dandy, but I think sometimes it gets lost in why you try to keep doing that, and why I've continued fighting and tried to conquer the world. And, you know, I think you try to keep up that American fighting spirit that, you know, you might be knocked down, but you're not out, and you got to keep fighting. And, you know, and I try to exemplify that, and because there are wounded warriors out there and a lot of veterans who, you know, need that help up and they need that inspiration. So, you know, it's not really so much about me as it is trying to inspire people and help people and help a fellow wounded warrior up and give them a hand up that they need so they can get back on that horse and get back to trying to conquer the world the way, you know, and conquer your battles one battle at a time, just like we were meant to be.
How concerned are you right now about the state of affairs, both for the job that the men and women of our military are tasked to do, and the shape that our military is in right now?
I think there is way too much social engineering going on and way too many pet progressive causes, and I don't know, focus on just letting our brave men and women to let them do their jobs. You know, I would say when fighting global warming is apparently supposed to be more important than killing ISIS, I would say we have a severe a lack of, you know, the best priorities out there. So there are a lot of changes that have been happening to the military. I don't agree with most of them, especially when they're made by people who have never served. They've never worn boots. They've never walked a mile in my boots or carried my pack. you know, and you really can't have people like that. You know, sometimes you just need to let the military do what it does best, and that is, of course, tackling our enemies, and our enemies are all over the place. ISIS is not contained. It's all over the place. It's in Europe. It's right here in America, and the reality is let our military do what it does. Stop micromanaging. Stop getting it sidetracked with these ridiculous pet progressive causes, and you know, and the same thing goes with diplomacy with Iran. I'm one of the 871 American troops who were wounded by an Iranian shape charge. There were somewhere in the neighborhood of 230 or 240 troops who were killed by Iranian shape charges. And now apparently Iran's going to be our buddies after they captured 12 of our sailors and humiliated them around the world.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. All right, we're under another tornado warning here in Farmville, Virginia, so hopefully it'll hold off for the next 14 minutes or so. If not, Cameron Gray can take over the interview. You'll see me running for shelter. Luke Rosiak of the Daily Caller is with us on the program right now. Luke, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, I got to tell you, I saw this story earlier today, and I was really afraid that this would not get the attention that it deserves, quite frankly. There's, you know, a lot of political news out there, a lot of election news going on, but this is, I think, a very important story. What happens when somebody fails to do their job in the government? Do they get fired? Do they get canned? Or do they get quietly moved halfway around the world at their current salary and maybe end up in a better position financially than they were beforehand?
Right, and the latter is certainly what happens with top executives of the Department of Veterans Affairs. It's just been kind of people, there's been some attention about how they rarely fire people, and it has to do with the union protections and things like that, which is especially ridiculous because that's carried up to the managers, who are certainly not unionized. I mean, you've got union-like job security for CEO-like positions. So I looked through the personnel records, and I found that 100 Veterans Affairs executives at the very top levels of hospitals have been moved between three or more states in the last 7 or 8 years. So, and when you look into it more closely, what you find is that there's a disaster at Hospital A, so they move that director at Hospital B. Meanwhile, Hospital B is probably pretty much on fire, so they move that director to Hospital A. They pretty much swap these guys around, so it's musical chairs.
Yeah, this is, you know, you highlight the case of Rima Nelson, who was in charge of the St. Louis Department of Veterans Affairs Hospital. Potentially exposed 1,800 patients to HIV. The hospital was closed twice for serious medical safety issues, ranked dead last in patient satisfaction. But you say she got moved to this seldom used clinic, the only foreign facility that the VA runs in Manila. She's got a government provided condo. She's still at $160,000 a year. And now she's in a place where the average person makes $2,500 a year. But this is far from the only story, right? I mean, you're talking about nearly 100 managers throughout the VA system that are sort of in what you guys call the bad bosses merry-go-round.
Right, and if your listeners Google that phrase, VA's bad bosses merry-go-round, you can see a map, an interactive graphic that shows VA hospitals near you, and you can see their lines crisscrossing the nation as they're moved from one place to another, almost always because of some problem, either in the source or the destination, oftentimes involving serious misconduct or, at the least, underperformance. So, you know, Secretary Bob McDonald came in after the last guy resigned because of serious scandals, and McDonald said, I'm going to do a big transformation of this place. But he's just moving the same old people around. So how are you going to fix it? How are you going to bring dramatic change with the exact same people that got us into this mess? Now, in the same, actually the same jobs, just in different physical locations.
And is this, I mean, so you get a manager, they're not doing their job, they're not meeting expectations. And again, so you just move them to a new facility without, with the hope that what, maybe they just need a change of pace, they need a fresh start?
I don't think it's even to rehabilitate them, it's to manage the public relations for the department. If you look at the scandal involving the manipulation of wait times, the issue was that they were making veterans wait months or years to come see a doctor, and they were dying in the meantime. And they dealt with that by altering the documentation, so it didn't look like they were waiting long. So they could have fixed the problem by just reducing wait times, but instead they managed the optics of it. They dealt with it on the public relations basis. So what happens is in individual cities, people are reading their local newspaper and they're realizing that there's big scandals at a given hospital and the tension builds up and the veterans are mad. And then the director is gone and everyone breathes a sigh of relief and they assume naturally that this person has been fired. But if you zoom out to the national scale from the VA's perspective, that person has not been fired. They've just been moved to another facility where residents of that location say, oh, God, well, good, we got a new director because the old one was bad, so this is a fresh start for us. So especially in, I think, prior years when the media, we didn't have the Internet and things were very localized, people didn't know what was going on across the country. This was a scheme that I think worked pretty well. It's also very much what the Catholic Church did with pedophile priests, where they would shuffle them from place to place, and they would stay there until they attracted enough attention and people were starting to get suspicious, and then they would move on just in time before it sort of reached a critical mass.
You know, you you say in your story here that head of the St. Louis VA system, who's now in the Philippines, has been gone from St. Louis for nearly 3 years, but the Veterans Administration has yet to replace her with a permanent successor?
They said not a single person has applied for that job. But that's, I mean, it tells you how much that hospital was in disarray. It really was atrocious what happened there. And now the lady, again, she's making $160,000 in a country where the minimum wage is $1 a day. So she made out pretty well for herself. But that hospital was left in tatters. No one wants to work there. The VA's big line right now is that the $180,000 that hospital directors and associate directors make is not enough, and that's why they can't attract people, which is true in one sense. If you want good people, the private sector, university hospitals and stuff, pay more than that. But I can tell you for a fact that none of these university hospitals and other prestigious private hospitals are trying to recruit these VA people. They're not, because you can look at the map I made and see them move 4, 5, 6 times across the country, selling the house, uprooting their families, to cling to this $180,000 government paycheck. If they had one single company that was willing to pay them more, they would take it in a second.
Talking again with Lou Groziak of the Daily Caller. And so you've got, again, this interactive map where folks can see where this is happening. And it seems like it is happening all around the country, right? This isn't just one region where we're seeing this. This is a systemic problem.
It's definitely a systemic problem. It's mostly in the VA, but to some extent it has to do with government-wide, the inability to discipline bad government workers. It has to do with the unions and the bodies like the MSPB and the equal opportunity, you know, basically false equal opportunity complaints where if you're fired, you just immediately claim discrimination openly based on nothing, just as a way to gum up the works and have a hope of getting reinstated to your job. And that applies to lower level people, but also the people who have very senior roles. And normally, you know, that those are the last people that have union-like protections, you would think.
Listen, Luke, I appreciate your reporting on this. Is this something that you're still investigating? Can we expect more stories about what's going on with the VA?
Yeah, checking out the Daily Caller. The VA has the dailycaller.com. Department of Veterans Affairs has got a whole host of problems, and I'm going to continue to write on this exact topic tomorrow and later this week as well.
All right. Well, listen, I do appreciate what you're doing, and I appreciate you coming on the program, Luke. It's good talking with you today.
You too.
Luke Groziak with the Daily Caller News Foundation. Joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company, about what's going on with the VA system. Again, the revolving, we talk about the revolving door of justice on this program quite a bit, where you see career criminals who time and time again commit a crime, they get their plea bargain, they are soon back out on the streets, where they commit another crime and, you know, just rinse and repeat as necessary. This is sort of the same thing involving government employees, bureaucrats, who it doesn't matter if you do a poor job. You still have your job. We'll just move you to a new location. Yeah, sure, maybe the scuttlebutt gets around work that, you know, there were some problems with the previous facility that you worked at, but you know, you're really not going to have the news media come in and cover these stories. You buy yourself some time. You're able to say, well, we got rid of the problem at the previous facility, right? You don't say we moved that problem to a new facility. As Luke said, it is managing the optics as opposed to dealing with the problem. And it's that type of attitude, I think, that has a lot of Americans so frustrated and disappointed with Washington. Because, frankly, they don't do a very good job of managing the optics. Right? Even first of all, their priorities are in the wrong place. If you're more interested in managing the optics than you are in fixing the problem, your priorities are messed up. But you can't even do that very well. You can't even manage the optics very well because, again, it might not be the local news media going and covering these stories, finding out who the previous or who this person is and where they came from, what did they do at their previous facility. Although we may actually be starting to see more of that now. But there will be individuals like Luke. There will be veterans. There will be patient advocates. There will be whistleblower employees. It'll come out sooner or later. So the only way to actually manage the optics is to fix the problem. That's what they don't get. You can try to come up with, whatever spin you want to come up with. But we, the people, are fairly savvy. And we can recognize spin when that's what it is. Because we've been given spin for so long, we've become fairly adept at recognizing it. We haven't actually seen a whole lot of, well, let's fix the problem. But I think we're actually still adept enough to recognize that when it happens. If it happens. All right, just a couple minutes left here in this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company. Sorry to disappoint Mr. Fastbucks on Twitter, but I don't think we're going to be blown away by a tornado in the next 90 seconds or so. But tune in tomorrow. Who knows? We might have a more severe weather here. In South Dakota, House Bill 1190 passing on Tuesday by a vote of 66-1. This would create a gold card concealed pistol permit, as well as upgrade the state's existing enhanced permit. Those who are approved for a gold card permit, once proper ATF approval would be given, would meet the minimum ATF requirements for a NICS background check exemption when purchasing a firearm. Also, with the passage of 1190, if this becomes law, after a proper ATF approval, current holders of the enhanced South Dakota concealed carry permit would also meet the minimum ATF requirements for a NICS background check exemption. Again, 66-1 was the vote in the South Dakota State House on this measure. It now heads over to the state Senate. If the anti-carry push that we are seeing from so many anti-gun activists right now around the country was a truly grassroots endeavor, you wouldn't see measures like this passing with almost unanimous support. You simply wouldn't. But again, the reality on the ground is far different than the narrative that is being crafted by those activists. That's about all the time we have for in this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company. We'll be back tomorrow, live 2 p.m. Eastern on NRAnews.com. Thanks again. We'll see you tomorrow.